Comic Timing is proudly sponsored by the New York Comic Con. New York Comic Con is bigger, better, and has double the space with more gaming and anime for 2007. Come to the Jacob Javits Center February 23rd to 25th and experience the biggest pop culture event in New York City, featuring comics, anime, manga, graphic novels, video games, trading card games, RPGs, MMOs, toys, movies, TV, celebrities, and more. Guest of honors include Stan Lee, Jeff Smith, J. Michael Straczynski, and George Perez, with many more to be announced. For a complete list of guests, as well as show information, please visit nycomiccon.com. Buy your tickets online now to ensure your spot for the 2007 show. Tickets are available now at a discounted rate for advance purchase at nycomiccon.com. You can also book your travel arrangements online now on the travel page of the website. Don't miss out on the 2007 New York Comic Con. Visit our website to get all the information you need.
Comic Timing is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network.
Why, hello there. I didn't see you come in. My name is the Monitor. That is what I do. I monitor things. I just don't monitor what happens in the DC Universe. I monitor what happens outside it as well. In that realm you folks out there call the real world. In my observation, I found these things called podcasts that you folks like to listen to. I especially enjoy the ones about comic books. In fact, I've truly been enjoying these two podcasts that seem to get along very well. Comic Timing and Rich and Bullets have been collaborating for some time now. In fact, it began at the very beginning of Comic Timing with a simple plug on Raging Bullets.
Before we continue on, I wanted to give a quick shout-out to a new podcast called Comic Timing. This is from our good friend David Price, who's had some email submissions to us previously, Toby Cook and Ian Levenstein, and it's a great roundtable comic book discussion about all comics, and I'm wishing them a lot of luck, and if you're looking for a new podcast, definitely give that one a shot, because they're great people.
This one simple plug changed the entire course of your universe. In fact, in a matter of days after this was released, Raging Bullets ended up on Comic Timing, and the first crossover began.
This week, David Price, our Man of a Thousand podcast, is off in Florida having fun. So we are joined by special guests from the Raging Bullets podcast, Sean and Jim. How's it going, guys?
Great, thanks.
Hello.
Alas, it did not end there. Soon, Sean returned to Comic Timing to discuss Infinite Crisis along with Vince B, who tried to convince him that the ending was just lackluster and poor. Sean, however, maintained his dignity and pride.
And see, I get sad when I hear you guys explain how much animosity you have towards this series when I enjoyed even the ending so much. It unleashed for me a desire to follow 52. I feel bad that you didn't get that same experience out of it because, and I don't think that's your fault. I'm not sitting here going, oh my gosh, I can't believe they didn't see this. I'm more so saying it's very telling as far as did the series accomplish its goal.
Now we stand on the heels of a brand new endeavor. Not just a one-sided crossover, but a crossover stemming on two planes, Comic Timing and Raging Bullets. This is the Confidential Crossover. Superman Confidential number 1 on Comic Timing. Batman Confidential number 1 on Raging Bullets. Ian Levenstein, Matt Summer, Sean Whalen, Jim Seculin. Let the games begin. I'll be watching.
Hey there, folks. My name's Ian Levenstein, and welcome to episode 26 of Comic Timing. It's 22 pages number 2, and it's also part 1 of the confidential crossover between Raging Bullets and Comic Timing. Joined, as always, by the man who just finished moving back his stuff to Scranton, PA. He's Matt Summer.
How's it going, Ian?
Doing pretty well, man.
By the way, I think this is 30-some pages for this book, though. I think you have to change the title.
Yeah, well, that's after the ads, so we'll get into that later on. Also joining us are the Raging Bullets guys. He's Dr. Norge in the Comic Geek Speak forums. He's Sean Whalen, and I'm also joined by Jim. I have three thumbs if you count my big toe. Sensei of the whatnot, Seguin.
How
Outstanding.
He's kicking my shit.
I have been wanting to say that all day. Guys, how you doing?
We're doing very well, thank
doing
you.
Doing outstanding now.
I'm glad I just made your whole day a little shinier right there. Oh, boy. Yeah.
It takes so little.
Yeah. Well, we're here to discuss Superman Confidential number 1, which is actually a collaboration, and I believe this is the first time that Darwin Cook and Tim Sale have ever done anything together, if I remember this correctly, because I don't think they've ever really worked together as a team before. So this is Darwin Cook and Tim Sale, both on storytelling. Dave Stewart is the colorist. Richard Starkings is on letters. Mark Chiarello is the editor, and Tom Palmer Jr. is the associate editor. And also a reminder to everybody out there that this episode is chock full of spoilers for Superman Confidential number 1. And also at the very end of the episode, some very slight spoilers, very, very slight spoilers for Nightwing. But that's in the end credits. You can very easily skip that if you wish to do so. Nevertheless, if you haven't read Superman Confidential number 1, and I guess if you haven't read that issue of Nightwing that started off the Wolfman run, then you might want to skip this episode. Just fair warning before we get into the bulk of the episode here. Now, before we get into the actual issue, I want to talk about the ads, because I want to get the bad out first before we get to the good, because this was a major, major annoyance for me when actually reading this issue here, and I'm wondering whether or not I was the only one who actually felt this way. So I want to ask Matt first. Matt, how much did these 3D glasses piss you off?
Well, you don't like that sweet HeroScape thing? I don't know. I guess I didn't really get too annoyed at that. I could really do without the 8-page Teen Titans interlude in there, especially with the new added-in Pokemon character, it looked like. in any event, I don't know. It didn't bother me that much, I guess.
Well, I don't know if they were quite out of Pokemon, but at the same time, put it at the end of the story. You know, because when you have something that's, I'm counting the pages now, this thing was, let's see here.
Well, it's 40-some pages, and a good chunk of that is, yeah, about half is ads, I think.
Let's see, 1, 2, on the actual Teen Titans thing, 3, 4, 5, 6, if you count the cover, 7 pages, and then there's an ad immediately following that, then you get back to the story. And it's almost like there's a commercial in the book. That's the way it felt for me. I mean, Sean, were you bothered by this as much as I was here?
Jim and I are both wearing our 3D glasses right now, actually. So
oh, really? Okay, great. Yeah.
See, makes the world pop.
Everything around us looks like it's in 3D. Great.
That's great, yeah. They're working really well. It must be that new technology they have, yeah.
I got to say, I don't know that it so much bothered me, but I will say that I noticed it, which I don't normally, when I read a comic, notice that there's ads. I mean, I look at them when they go through, but I mean, I'm never like, geez, there's, you know, a great deal of ads in here. There was in this one. So I did really notice it more this time than I have. I can't remember ever, like, thinking to myself, geez, there's just a lot going on here. Man.
Well, didn't you guys think it was worth it that they, you know, they lowered the price because they put so many ads in there?
I would pay the higher price.
No, I'm just kidding, actually.
Well, at the same time, they didn't even lower the damn price. It's
$2.99. What I'm saying is I would pay $3.99 for this to be without the ads.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
You put it out there now.
Look out. Look out, DC. If Dan DiDio, if you're listening, once again, why are you listening? Jim, what about you? I mean, were they under your skin?
I tell you, I got to disagree with all of you. I ran out. I bought the Teen Titans Go after reading this. You
know, really?
Halfway through this, I put it down. I'm like, man, I got to get the rest of this issue.
Oh,
you
know, wow.
I ran to my local shop.
Please tell me you're pulling my leg.
Of course.
It's got to be sarcastic.
Come on.
Okay, it better have been.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it did irk me a little bit. And it was funny because I heard a bunch of people complaining about it, you know, on different forum threads and, you know, a couple other just rants on it. I was like, come on, how distracting could it have been? It distracted me. It actually, because it broke up just the flow of the comic. And I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, because Superman's about to get hit by something, and then we'll be back after these messages brought to you by, you know.
After these 10 pages.
Exactly. Introducing Sarah Hunter. And it was Todd Knock art, so I hate to say anything negative about Todd Knock art. It's just it didn't belong there. Put it at the end of the issue. Put it in its own little thing that you're handing out at the comic shop for you know, free or something like that. Just don't put it in the issue.
Well, I will say, and I said this before, that when I was first collecting in the mid-80s, that, you know, I first learned about my love Blue Devil by reading the insert, the 16-page insert in the in the Firestorm issue, but that seemed like you're getting something for free. It seemed like a bonus and not a big advertisement for something else, even though I guess it was still an advertisement for something else. But
And also, God, the 3D glasses in general, man. I mean, when you put 3D glasses inside of an issue, when I opened the issue, it automatically opened up to about page 4. And I hate that, because when I'm reading it, I'm always afraid that my hand is going to go to the wrong page, because the entire issue is unbalanced because of that. And this might be nitpicky on me here, okay? Because I hate opening up automatically to halfway through the damn story because they put a freaking insert inside.
Well, what you guys don't know is that Ian's a professional comic book accuracy thrower. This totally threw off his balance. He stabbed someone in the eye.
I had pictures of him reading his book crooked.
No, actually,
on a tightrope.
Yeah, I read it. I read it the way that Rob Liefeld drew that one issue when he was told not to. You know, I read it the long way in the movie style. Just seriously, I mean, DC's got to learn from their mistakes here. Hopefully, enough people, you know, actually spoke about this, because the thing is, this isn't the only issue that got this treatment this month, because it was the first one that I saw. But then about 2 weeks later, I started seeing other comics with the exact same damn insert and the same Teen Titans story about halfway through. I mean, you got to have better placement for these things.
Let's see how anal we are as comic fans. Did anybody actually take out the 3D glasses?
No.
I didn't either.
It's not mint.
No.
So they're all still in there.
Well, I just took out my Superman Red, Superman Blue, which came with those 3D glasses, and just used that instead.
You know, it was hard to actually look at that 3D stuff with the glasses still in the book, but...
We had to buy a second copy so you could look at it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right.
Well,
sure.
We had, like, what, 10 books with it in there this month, so.
My favorite part is that I'm a regular reader of the xaxis.net, which is, I think that's the website. It's either the xaxis.com or the xaxis.net. He's a X-Men reviewer, basically. He reviews a whole bunch of comics. And he's been complaining for the past 2 weeks about Marvel's ads and how they're getting excessive. Well, this sort of eclipsed that for me here, because at least Marvel's not doing inserts yet. They're just doing a whole bunch of advertisements, which I can sort of stand a little more than having that annoying 3D glasses in there. And I'm sorry that I'm harping on this. It's just, it really took me out of the story.
Well, let me ask you this question then. Would you rather have, like Marvel was doing for a while, they were doing these actual in-panel product placements?
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather see that, or would you rather just have an insert that you could flip past?
You're damn right I would. You're damn right I would. And I might be in the minority there, but I'd much rather have, you know, in the background or something like that, you know, drink Coca-Cola than something like that. Because guess what? When I turn on the TV, I'm seeing that anyway. So it's not, it doesn't really bother me too much. It just, you know, makes it feel a bit more like the real world. Instead of seeing soda or cola on a sign, you'll see Coca-Cola.
Yeah, but where goes the Big Belly Burger if you can have McDonald's and Burger King in there? I don't know. The only thing that bothered me about this was that it looked like a really fat, you know, it was like 40-some pages,
mm-hmm.
but it was only 20 pages with the story, so
yeah.
It's kind of a letdown.
Well, here's what you do, and I'm sure Sean will love this. You have Batman dress up like the Burger King King for Halloween.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, you can Hawkman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that'll
work. Carter Hall's big return, he's dressed as, you know.
Remember this Sunday where we record, I'm bringing a mace.
Well, I can't wait to see what Jim's reaction is to Shadow of the Hawk the second time around, so.
All right, man, bitched about the ads enough?
Close to the chest. Yeah. I ain't saying
You know
anything.
What? Just to sum up the ad thing, though, how would you feel if they were at the end of the book? Instead of having them placed all the way through, would you look at them? Mm-hmm. If they put them at the end of the book. Because that becomes the issue for them.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Actually, I admit, I would skim through them just to see if there's anything that catches my eye. Say if it's an advertisement for, you know, a tie-in video game or something like that, or any advertisement that just might catch my eye, I might do it. Because, well, quite frankly, I'm a geek. I'm looking for new geek things to find. But I'd much rather do that after I'm done reading the story. You know, I'm actually more intent on skipping through the ads entirely and not looking at them when they're in the middle of the story. If it's afterwards, I might actually look at them.
And so. I would, too. With as many DC books as I read, if they put them at the end, through one of the books that they were in, I would actually look at them. But I don't have to see this in every single book. If they put them at the end, that would give me the option then to look at them at my leisure after I'm done reading the book.
Yeah, I guess that's the same thing with the TV now, with the TiVo and fast-forwarding and stuff. People are... They don't know what to do with the ads, and I got to be honest with you, I don't think I've ever bought a product because of a comic book ad.
Well, hey, Sim, you never bought like the goggles that, you know, make you see through clothes on the back
X-ray
of the
specs.
Yeah, X-ray specs.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah, to bring up something we were talking about before we started recording. Yeah, I did get hooked on fruit pies from Marvel from the comic ads. But other than that, no,
it was Twinkies for me. So I'm definitely.
Jim, would you read the ads if they were put in the back as opposed to, say, you know, scattered through the middle of the comic?
If it was a comic book related, probably. But if it was just some random thing, I'd just skip right through it.
Okay, so
if it had some cool look to it, or if they're advertising, like, coming next month, this mm-hmm. comic, I'd stop and look and see what it was. But
don't you do that anyway. You skim through the ads that you're not interested in anyway. So
right.
The placement in the back, you'd still look through them in the same way yeah. that you'd look at them in the regular
comic. Actually, I'd probably look more in the back because I'd look to see if there was something included in with that
yeah.
that was interest. Whereas when I'm in the middle of, when I'm in the zone reading, I just, you know, I don't even look at what it is. Like that 3D glasses thing, I don't know what it's for. I honestly do not know what products that's for. I just know there was a thing with the 3D glasses, and I just skip right through it.
What does it mean, the chunk?
Hero Scape.
When I'm in the zone, I just chunk.
you know, zip through
well,
it.
I just imagine him with like the Gatorade bottle with all
see,
headband on.
I'm glad to see that Jim doesn't just save the Raging Bulletisms just for Raging Bullets, that we get to have them here on Comic Timing as well. So
see, this is me. This is who I am. So, you know, it's not like
take
I'm
him
turning
as he
anything
is.
On.
He's a chunk freak.
And whatnot.
Love him.
Oh, man. All right, let's actually talk about the issue as a whole here. Initial impressions on the issue before we get into, you know, page-by-page analysis here. I mean, what did you think of Superman Confidential number one? We'll start with you, Sean.
Overall, I really enjoyed the exploration into the inner workings of Superman's head. Mm-hmm. You know, what he was thinking in this early era. I liked that. One minor nitpick, I wanted to see more with the kryptonite. Like, the whole thing was supposed to be about first appearance of kryptonite.
Yeah.
And I want more of that. I like the issue, though, so I mean, that's not saying that I didn't enjoy it. I really liked, like I said, the inner, because Superman a lot of times has been one of those characters for me I have trouble relating to at certain points,
mm-hmm.
and this is one of those issues where I really like the guy a lot, and that's important when he's the main character in the book.
Was it the art that really drew you in, or was it the story, or a combination of both?
I love Tim Sale. I think his art's great, because he's got that, like, film noir style that
yeah.
he has whenever he does anything with Jeff Loeb, so
mm-hmm.
I'm drawn to that stuff right away. It's an art style that I really enjoy, so that definitely was a draw. I think the combination of the two, though, because, you know, Darwin Cook's style isn't too far from Tim Sale's.
Yeah.
So the two obviously get each other.
Yeah.
So the story was obviously one that was perfect for both.
Now, Sean, and Jim, both of you, I'm sure both you guys fans are fans of Heroes. So, Jim, did you enjoy seeing the Heroes artist take a stab at Superman?
I didn't know.
I knew it. Yeah, the guy who drew this issue, Tim Sale, was actually the same guy who does all of the art you see scattered through Heroes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
Actually, now that you say that, I'm like, yeah, I can see that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what was your impression of the issue in general?
Well, it was funny. This one is a definite argument for me why mm-hmm. I need to read a comic book multiple times.
Okay.
Because the first time through, I wasn't that impressed with it. I was like, it was okay. And I was trying to come up with reasons why, you know, I didn't like it, because I didn't want to just say, oh, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
So, and as I'm reading it the second time through, I started understanding what was really going on with Soup, and you know, actually, it was actually the second time through that I really started liking the art style as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, this was, you know, kind of a weird experience going through one time and going through a second time, where my opinion basically did a 180 on it, where I went from not being too impressed to being, man, I can't wait for number two to come out, I can't wait for more of this stuff, because I really want to see what they're going to do with this.
I'm actually in a similar boat to you because, you know, as I mentioned before with the ads, I was completely drawn out of the issue. And once I ignored the ads and just actually, you know, read the story, I just read it through it two times before we started recording here. And I like it a lot more now than I did then. So I'm sort of in the same boat with you there. Matt, you're up.
All right. Before we get any further into this, let's just briefly, if you mind, let's talk about what the confidential book is supposed to be about.
Okay.
The line philosophy. The philosophy of the confidential line is simply that, sort of like the all-star line, which, you know, I'm not really sure why all these exist at the same time, but confidential line is supposed to be a rotating panel of creators that tell stories from early in the careers.
Yeah.
Of the various heroes. Generally, they will deal with first meetings, first appearances, big events that happened in the character's life.
Mm-hmm.
And as Sean mentioned, the theme of this first arc is Superman's first meeting or exposure to kryptonite.
Yeah.
And we're building towards that as we go through. As far as just general impressions, then, of this issue, I found it kind of a strange story on some levels, because it's obviously, you know, it's obviously set in a more of a modern time, but the art style and kind of the writing style harken back to me to sort of a Silver Age-y feel.
Yeah.
To it, where you know, you have, like you said, in the staff room, it's almost like, you know, they're in the 30s or 40s or something. You have these guys with fedoras on going like, "Hey, Lois, bet you $20, you don't get that scoop." You know? And so there's that kind of thing going on, and then there's but then they're on cell phones and that kind of stuff. And, you know, so it was a mixed feel of, I guess, the time where this story belongs. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It sort of goes along with, I think, the way that they did the Superman cartoon and the Batman animated series, kind of a mix of modern and sort of, like you said, noir style kind of stuff. The storyline, obviously, we have this situation is, you know, far as with this casino that's moving into town, and Perry White is convinced some kind of dastardly thing going on, and has them investigated. I thought it was a little weird that he basically came out and said, you know, of the entire planet organization, I can only trust you three.
Yeah.
That seemed a little far-fetched to me, but obviously it's just there to set up this meeting with this new character. And as far as I know, I mean, has that character, that Tony, whatever his name was, has he ever been in comics before?
I never really heard him before. Sean, is he a familiar name to you?
I don't remember Anthony Gallo appearing anywhere.
Okay.
I'll look to see if there's anything on him.
Well, you know what? He really felt like, and again, this could just be me maybe wanting to see somebody more familiar. And I know that, you know, it felt like it was much more.
Do you want to know what came up? I just looked on Wikipedia.
What?
Gay adult film star.
Oh, man. Well, this episode is certainly taking a turn that I did not expect it to go, and I guess we know.
I went to the, you know, the usual Wikipedia. Figured, all right, somebody, if he was a character in the comic, there's going to be an article up there. There was.
Well,
but I don't think it's our Anthony Gallo.
I certainly
maybe we know what. What's Darwin Cook doing in his spare time? I don't know.
Oh, John.
Just kidding, by the way.
Good night, everybody. This has been a great experience.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with that, exactly. has the gay witch hunt not taught us anything? But
exactly.
Now, I felt like Anthony Gallo was sort of like a Lex Luthor fill-in for me. They really wanted it to be him, but because of where this was being set, he had already been introduced, so obviously him coming into, you know, the area would have made a little less sense. And at the same time, he had a little bit of an inner gang vibe to me. So I don't know if that's what they were going for, but he felt like sort of like a combination between, you know, say a head of inner gang and Lex Luthor to me. And I might have rather seen somebody from inner gang than this character that I don't believe I've ever seen before in the comics.
Well, obviously I think they're setting them up. You know, there's going to be more to, more than meets the eye. And you're right. For some reason, I had this Tony Stark thing going on with him.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it was just the name and the goatee. I don't know, but
I can see that though. You know, I'll admit I didn't think that when I was reading it. But when you say that now, I'm like, all right, I can see where he's going with that.
But you know, the thing is with that character, like you said, it was kind of strange because it definitely had sort of a Lex Luthor vibe to it. But then he also mentioned the fact that Luthor was hassling him.
Yeah.
In the story, and so there was. It's kind of overlap, and obviously there's something to this character because I don't know if we want to get into this right now, but on the first read through, I did not understand what was supposed to be so significant about the last panel in the story.
Okay.
I was like, okay, why did they sign that panel? What's so great about that? And then second time through, I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. So sort of interesting, I guess, to see where that's going to play out.
Now, see, yeah, I can understand what you're talking about there. And I guess we should maybe hold that off until the end, though, because now that we're talking about it, first read through, I sort of felt the same way. I was looking for the next page when I was done reading this. It didn't feel like an end to me. I turned it, and I saw DC Nation, and I'm like, did my comic miss a couple pages here? What the hell's going on? You know, because there wasn't even a the end or anything. It was just like, you know, signed, that's it. Game over, come back next issue. You know, it was very abrupt to me. Like, the story was just getting going. So, if there's something that we want to talk about now, we can. If not, then we'll hold it off.
Right. Did you guys, Sean, Jim, do you guys catch that on the first read-through, that last panel?
I know what you're talking about, Don, his finger?
Right.
Yeah. Did you catch
that hangnail?
Yeah.
I didn't catch anything.
Okay.
Okay.
As we get to that point, yeah. We'll talk about that. As far as what Ian was saying, though, about how it just kind of ended abruptly, I think that was my little nitpick about it. I enjoyed the issue. I enjoyed what was here content-wise, especially after, you know, going through and reading it again. I think that's something that we're all kind of feeling here, that it read better as you've revisited it. Mm-hmm. But I definitely felt like at the end of it, I wanted more.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not necessarily such a bad thing, but I felt like we're just getting started and I want something else here.
It might have also been the size of the comic. Because of all the ads, I was shocked that it ended where it did. You know, like wow, this is supposed to be a huge story here. Wait, regular 22-page comic?
And holding it feels like one of those old prestige format books.
Yeah.
Because it's got that kind of weight to it and all that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But again, half the weight is because of those goddamn 3D glasses.
Man, he's never going to let that down.
I'm never going to let that go.
3D glasses killed Ian's mother.
It wasn't even those cool ones that don't have the two, you know, they're still going with the red and the blue here. These days, they've got ones that are all white and still do the same job. Damn it! All right, I'm done.
I might make that a Raging Bullets contest. We'll try to get all of our listeners to send Ian Levenstein 3D glasses.
Oh, great. Just what I want sent to my doorstep, man. Oh, God. Anyway, let's actually get to the front of the issue here. Now, we start off with the narration. Here's the biggest question. Is this the kryptonite talking here, or is this something inside the kryptonite? I mean, last I checked, kryptonite wasn't sentient. I mean, what's the deal here? You know, I mean, this is very confusing to me. I mean, was it confusing to you guys as well? I mean, am I the only one here that's wondering what the hell it was?
First sentence in my notes that I took here is, was that the kryptonite talking in the beginning? Because I wasn't sure. And I know, as we talked about this before we started recording, that it was thrown out there that there might be something inside it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'd actually be a little bit more comfortable with something being inside it than it actually being that the kryptonite was talking. Because I don't want living, breathing, talking kryptonite.
Well, I had a suggestion, and bear with me here. I think it's Brainiac. And there's one line in that narration that makes me think it was Brainiac. Ours is to know. Mine was to observe and at my discretion record. Miscalculation had led to this. I am linked to this Kryptonian creature born together through unknown galaxies. That feels like Brainiac to me because, you know, he's that type of guy who was always, you know, trying to find out all the information he can about, well, at least one of his incarnations, this was definitely the case, where, you know, he was more of an observer who was trying to, you know, get information on things. So it's pretty possible that, you know, he was on Krypton when it exploded, was caught into it, and, you know, ended up inside the kryptonite. That's what I'm thinking here. But
it even says, without him, I cannot exist.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, there is a definite connection there. It also could be, like, the Eradicator-type character.
It's certainly possible, yeah.
Right. It's got to be – I guess what we're trying to get at is that it has to be something. Whatever it is, it better not just be the damn rock talking to us.
Yeah. It's like, I'm Kryptonite. I'm green. Nice to see you.
It's the Barney of Krypton.
Jim, did you think it was the rock talking or something inside it?
I honestly thought it was the rock talking, and I was like, wow, this is going to be interesting. Where are they going with this? A talking rock. I'm like, okay. I was hoping it was something else, but I honestly thought a Brainiac, Eradicator, none of those even entered my head. I was just thinking it was a talking slab of kryptonite.
Yeah. You know, just think about it. Of all the Superman stories we've had, we've never had one from the Kryptonite's point of view. So, here we go.
It's certainly very Silver Age. You know, so right up Jim's alley. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean,
it's the story that demands to be told.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, yeah, Kryptonite. How the hell did I get here?
Not an imaginary story. Kryptonite speaks.
Now, after we have the whole landing of the Kryptonite, we're then immediately sent to an entirely different setting, entirely different scene with the Royal Flush Gang in Metropolis. Somebody better get that.
You know, you're just the kind of movie. You're just the kind of people, Jim, that I hate sitting by at the movie.
Oh, jeez.
Bastard.
Wait, we're recording here.
I'm recording. Is this an emergency?
Oh, man. Did anybody else? You guys, if you looked at that.
Fine.
Okay, I guess we'll just.
30 something episodes and you don't know how to shut off a cell phone?
Oh, my God. This is officially.
Sorry.
This is the best moment of my podcasting career right here.
Awesome. Right. You know what? This is what I want to ask you guys as far as the art goes. If you have your issue there, and you just talked about that, they switched to the Royal Flush Gang. Did anybody else get a total Walt Simonson vibe off that page?
Yeah, definitely. That first page there, right away, especially with the way that that the entirely white character looks. That's
Ace, I think that
there
is,
you go,
right?
Ace. Yeah, he screams Simonson to me.
Like
so
his Thor stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. It feels like, you know, one of those giants he used to draw, or at least one of those sort of things. Definitely get a Simonson vibe from the art. It's not very Sale, though, and that's what I'm wondering here, because the whole thing doesn't quite feel like Tim Sale art to me. And I don't know whether or not it's just the fact that, you know, he's working on a whole bunch of different things now with the hero stuff, with, you know, with a whole a couple of other comic things that I know he has in the pipeline. I mean, was he rushed here? I don't know, because it's good stuff, don't get me wrong. It looks a little bit different than a typical, you know, Tim Sale book, like, say, Superman of All Seasons, which was years ago, but still, it does feel a bit different to me. And I don't know whether or not I'm the only one thinking that.
Did Darwin Cook do any of the artwork on this? I mean, I'm wondering, is it any possibility that this is, like, both of them, and that's why we're seeing something slightly different?
That could be,
Says in the beginning, I'm looking, I just, when you started talking about this, I'm like, let me look back at the credits.
Uh-huh.
And it says Darwin Cook and Tim Sale storytellers. And that doesn't mean anything. It could mean that just Darwin Cook wrote it and Tim Sale did the pencil work.
Yeah.
But I'm just throwing out there, trying to come up with an explanation. I don't have a good explanation
It's a possibility, I guess. Because even with the next page, once you see the Royal Flush Gang, that's Superman. It's Sale-esque, but it's not quite Sale, if you catch my drift. You know, it looks a bit sketchier than I'm used to seeing.
If you look at, again, if you look at that last panel in the book where they have the signing, it says Cook Sale 2006.
Yep, there you go.
So I don't know if that proves anything or not, but...
That actually, I guess, yeah, either they split up the art chores or it's possible maybe one of them did
outlines.
That could be. I don't know, because it would actually make a bit sense there to see why it does look a little bit different. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing that it looks different. And again, even on the DC site, it said written by Darwin Cook, art and cover by Tim Sale. So I don't know whether or not they did just collaborate to that point and it just wasn't mentioned in the credits or what, but it doesn't look quite like I was expecting it to. So I don't know. Anybody else get that vibe? I mean, Sean. I mean, you said it's possible that they could have been collaborating, but did you feel it was any different than, you know, Tim Sale art, especially Superman art that you've seen?
It definitely felt more Sale to me than Darwin Cook.
Okay.
So I mean, if there was a collaboration going on there, I feel that a majority of it leaned towards Tim Sale stuff. Because I mean, there's at no point in time did I really feel like Tim Sale didn't do any of the art.
Okay.
I felt like every panel was Tim Sale.
Okay.
I definitely see some differences though in things that I've seen from him before. So I could definitely see this being a collaborative effort, at least on some panels here and there. I don't know on what level, and I might be totally. I could be totally way off on that. That's the only explanation I can come up with. I will say that I felt that it was Tim Sale art all the way through as I was reading it.
All right, cool. And also, Jim, I got to ask you this, since you've said this in the past about, you know, having that moment. Did you get that feeling there with Superman carrying the truck like that? Because I got that.
Well, it was funny. First time through, I didn't. And that's why I was a little bit upset with the comic. And I'm so used to seeing and thinking that Superman is this godlike superhero that is unbeatable.
Yeah.
And this one seemed a little bit more vulnerable, a little bit, because he's just beginning and he's just getting into the role. So that kind of threw me off. And so I didn't have the bum ba 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 da moment when he was catching it. Now, when that was cool, when that big chunk of ice or whatever that was, you know, fell down, I was like, that looks kind of cool. And the fact that he survives it, I was like, that's kind of neat.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. But also, when it happened, I was a bit thrown by the fact that when it did happen, we're immediately sent to another scene. You know, we don't see him get out of it. We really don't see anything, you know, right, really going on with that. It's just all of a sudden, he's there sitting with Lois, and we're left to wonder exactly what happened.
Right, I do agree that I think that some of the visual storytelling was lacking in some of the panels. I think they relied a little too much on the narration to tell the story. Because just that sequence, like you said, I mean, he says, oh, yeah, okay, the truck explodes, and I was covered with ice, and then I crushed the thing. And all you see is an iceberg sticking out of the ground. You don't see him getting covered in it. You don't see him breaking out of it. You don't see anything happening like that. So, yeah, I don't know if they just had a lot of ground to cover and couldn't spend that much time on it or not. But, yeah, I do think that was lacking slightly.
The narration for me was, like, my favorite part of the story.
Yeah.
I really liked the narration because it was all inner dialogue from Superman. So that was actually, out of the whole book, that was the thing that hooked me in because I really need to connect with this character. I like Superman a lot, but there's stories of Superman that I just can't get into because I feel like he's almost, sometimes they go too far with his inhuman portrayal versus the human side of him, and it's really the Clark Kent character that I really like about Superman, and this was all Clark.
One of the cool things for me when that iceberg chunk fell down, the visual I got was very similar to the visual of the big slab of kryptonite sitting in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I kind of had a flashback to that moment. I thought that was kind of neat, showing them kind of interconnected, interrelated.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah,
good insight. Didn't even notice that.
Yeah, but and also, how about the use of the Royal Flush Gang as the villains here? Because I usually equate them more with Batman, so it's kind of cool seeing them, you know, in a Metropolis setting this time around. Mind you, there have been like three or four different Royal Flush Gangs, and we were talking about before we started recording how they've got one of the most complicated histories in the DC universe, and yet at the same time, whenever anybody needs to be beat up, they're brought in.
They've actually been pretty much mostly a Justice League villain over the years.
Okay.
Maybe your mind has been warped by the cartoon appearances.
Probably. But, I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a strange group. And like I mentioned this before, that the Royal Flush Gang has sort of become like the Wrecking Crew has in the Marvel Universe, where if you have a new character, they're there for the new character to kick their asses and show how cool they are. So, yeah, Royal Flush Gang, they basically get their asses handed to them every time they appear, and this is no different.
I totally love this one line a couple of pages into the fight. We're too close. They think I'm fearless, but each new cataclysm gives me one sharp instant of mortal fear. And then you see right after that, the mortal fear line then leads into one of the Royal Flush Gang. Oh, great. With this, you know, somber, expression on his face, like, we're about to get screwed again. And as if, you know, this is what they do for a living, getting their asses handed to them, and then they go on to their next job.
You know, and speaking of, as far as, like, the Royal Flush Gang, I mean, does it take the Dark Knight Detective to say, okay, casino and card guys appearing at the same time? I mean, is that that's the mystery of the ages? I don't know.
Golly gee whiz. I mean, Sean, what did you think of the interpretation of the Flush Gang here?
I really felt that the whole point with them is exactly what Matt was saying. I think it was to lead you right away that this Tony Gallo was paying them to get footage of Superman so that he could use it in the future. Other than that, they were really cannon fodder. They were there so we could get an insight into Clark's mind. Other than that, it didn't matter that it was the Royal Flush Gang, other than it was convenient that they were playing cards.
Yeah.
They weren't really important for anything other than, I mean, it was an important segment, but they weren't important. It was what Clark was doing and what he was thinking during the time that was the whole thing right there. And that connection to the villain, because we needed something, because that guy was really basically just at the end. And if we didn't have some kind of connection with the fight that Clark was going through and him,
sure,
it would have been hard to relate to what was going on in the story and why this Gallo guy is even important.
So it's better than having just random thugs.
I would say, yeah, just tying, because of the playing card thing and tying him into the casino, at least there is some kind of connection, which I think we need at this point.
See, I didn't see the Full House gang connected to the
Full House gang.
Hey, can you call them Royal Flush? They get beaten very easily.
Uh-huh. Okay, yes, but if you call them the Full House gang,
I think of
Uncle Jesse changing Michelle's diapers. So,
Bob Saget is the ace.
You know what? I would like to see that. Not in this book, but...
Well, great. If they're ever in a Superman movie, cast Bob Saget as Ace. Brilliant right there. Jim, what experience do you have with the Royal Flush Gang? I mean, did you know them before? You've seen them on this page here? Have you read any comics with them before?
The only experience I have to them is in the different cartoons.
Okay. And how does this interpretation match up to what you saw there on the cartoons?
About the same. It was even. You know, I think I remember them in Batman Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess, yeah, that's, I think, pretty much my main memory of them.
That's why I remember them as Batman, yeah.
You know, this seems like, you know, even comparison. And the one thing I noticed, they said they had LexCorp armor and LexCorp enhancements, not, you know, not the Gallo.
Yeah, that is true.
He
mentioned that as far as the Ace android thing. The guy makes a comment, oh, I didn't think he was that strong. Yeah, so again, yeah, it's a good catch.
Well, it's possible that they might be working both sides, you know, because obviously, I just finished reading for the second time, and actually expect the bullet points column on this eventually, Sean, on JLA Act of God that I recently read, where the villains are working for simultaneously Toyman and Lex Luthor, because what better way to get money than play both sides and, you know, get money from both? So it's damn possible they went to Lex Luthor for the armor and then went to Gallo and, you know, were recording this event for Gallo. So you never know.
Well, why do we, I guess aside from the fact that it's a casino and there's cards, why do we think that they have anything to do with Gallo?
You're right. It may be that we're digging for that and we're actually making a connection there that isn't actually true.
If anything, I could see that Luthor might hire them to try to get people to think that they're doing something with the casino when they're actually not involved.
It's true, yeah, because obviously since Luthor is mentioned for wanting to, you know, sort of get Gallo out of there, then obviously this could be a great ploy to, you know, convince people that, you know, Gallo is doing something shady when he might have not been. So, well, mind you, he is doing something shady, but maybe he's just not doing this. So who knows?
If he is doing anything shady, though, really.
Yeah. In either case, it actually makes that connection between the two.
I guess, yeah. Because actually, yeah, the first time that I read it through, I didn't even catch that connection. And then I'm like, oh, casino, cards, duh, you know, but it took the second read through before it actually, you know, clicked in my mind, oh yeah, that's why they're there. You know, before then, it literally was just, you know, random throwaway people, Superman needs to fight something, then let's go on with the main story. But it finally made sense in my head.
And just to get back what Matt said, I'm sorry, Mano, because you were in the middle of saying, we don't know for sure if there is anything being done wrong yet that hasn't been shown in the storytelling.
Right, because, I mean, that's the thing, like, he's set up, obviously, as, you know, we're told by Perry White that there's something fishy going on, but I don't think we've actually seen anything that he's done or said that actually leads us to know that he's a villain of any sort.
Yeah, it's possible that he's just, you know, a businessman, which, you know, can be a villain in some ways, you know, Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, the goatee means you're evil, so he's got to be a bad guy.
You've been watching a little bit too much Star Trek, buddy.
Yeah, mirror, mirror, there you go.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, note to self, never get a goatee or else people will think I'm evil.
My wife's right, I am evil.
Damn it! Oh, man. Well, the next scene immediately after this, you know, this fight with the Royal Flush Gang, as I mentioned before, all of a sudden we're at this nice, happy, peaceful moment between Superman and Lois. It came out of nowhere. I'm not saying it wasn't a beautiful scene, because it was, and here's where the art I felt was probably the best in the entire issue. Sale is good, if it is actually Sale, I think it is, on the solemn, more calm moments. And that's what we get here. I mean, the background, that purple sky with the stars, is absolutely gorgeous. You've got sort of a hunched over, macho-looking Superman with a little Red Riding Hood, Lois Lane, and it works incredibly well. My only problem is, where does this lead from the previous scene?
it's about, at least what I got out of it, it's about developing his insecurities.
Mm-hmm.
Because during the whole fight with the Royal Flush Gangs, it was his insecurities about, am I invulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
Am, you know, is something I'm going to do going to eventually kill me? And is this going to be that thing? I mean, that was, you know, he keeps referencing to that. When they flash to the lowest scene, it was about his insecurities in dealing with people. And, you know, knowing that as Superman, he doesn't have the time available for her. And he tries to overcompensate for that, but it's never going to be enough for her. I think the setup of this is just to develop a more human Superman,
mm-hmm.
for us to kind of see those insecurities. And then when actually this kryptonite is introduced, you know, see that he was right to be at least somewhat insecure because he isn't invulnerable. There are these things that can get to him. And Lois is obviously one of them. You know,
sure.
His relationship with her is something that has been and something that can be used against him.
For some reason, I found it. I don't know why. Maybe they set this up elsewhere. But for some reason, it just seemed like it was too soon for him to be dating Lois Lane in his career at that point. I don't know. He said he'd just only been out there as Superman for like 2 months.
Well, even with that, he had just talked about saving a plane of people about a
right.
week ago.
And if you go by the Man of Steel, and I don't know if he's basing this on the Byrne revamp or the, you know, the other one that was at Mark Waid just kind of did a revamp as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which one of those that's based on, but yeah, that was his like first public appearance as the character.
Yeah.
And I guess you can even say the movie as well. They did the same thing with the plane of people. So, yeah, it kind of just struck me as it seemed kind of strange to me for some reason that it was just so early in his career that he was already at that point. I don't know. Maybe that was just me. I don't know.
No, I can see that when you're saying it, too. I'm like, if you're considering the timing of everything in this, it really is too soon. They're too familiar in that date, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is that what you're getting at, Matt? That they're like,
yeah,
they
I think
seem
so.
To
it just
too
seems
comfortable?
Like, because he's just sitting there talking about, like, you know, oh, it's too early and I wish I would have met her later and all these kind of things. It, I don't know. It just seemed like it was too soon for them to have that relationship already started, you know, only 2 months after him starting to be Superman, that they're already doing the typical Superman Lois stuff.
Well, look, I gotta say, if I was a girl, okay, and there was a super dude who took me to the top of the Eiffel Tower for a frickin' date, I'm falling in love. You know, I mean, geez, I mean, this is a dude who could basically take you anywhere around the world. If you want Chinese food, you go to China, you know, as opposed to going to the, you know, the corner store in Metropolis.
And they just
know?
Call it food there.
Exactly.
Hey, and depending on which version of Anthony Gill you are, you might enjoy it too.
Oh.
And it had to go back there, didn't it?
Oh,
jeez. Jim, was this jarring at all for you, going from one scene to another like this? Or
no, actually, I really dig this. You know, I like seeing the Super Mac Daddy. You know, that was cool. You know, that's the ultimate pickup line. Here, let me take you to the top of the Eiffel Tower. And I had it, she was wearing his cape when, you know, the Little Red Riding Hood.
Mm-hmm.
I had that was like he gave her his cape. So I thought that was even extra kind of cool. Instead of like taking, you know, if she's cold, instead of taking off your jacket, he takes off the cape and drapes it on her. So
actually, now that I'm looking at it, that pretty much is the case because he's not wearing his cape while they're on top of the Eiffel Tower. So,
man, Jim, with all these insights today. He's embarrassing us.
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut.
Again, does that have to go back to the Gallo reference?
Oh!
Oh!
Wow. That's terrible.
So, this is what happens when Comic Timing and Raging Bullets cross over, huh? Immediately after we're at the Eiffel Tower, we're back at the Daily Planet. And this felt like the Daily Planet to me, but I'm sort of with Matt here. You know, what year is this taking place? Because there were some things here that, you know, felt a little bit too, like, old-fashioned, while other times, you know, felt like it was now. But I guess the buildings certainly made it feel like more like this was, say, happening in, I don't know, like maybe the late 80s as opposed to, you know, the 1940s when Superman started out. Because, well, architecture like that you'll only really find later on in the world. Even though Metropolis is supposed to be this great city, you're not going to see buildings like that when Perry is looking out the window. You're not going to see things like that back in the 40s.
Well, there's a weird juxtaposition because you have, you know, they have this kind of like old crazy looking 1940s tenement where Clark and Jimmy go set up.
Yeah.
right across from this weird futuristic casino building. Again, my only thing with this is just simply the fact that I know that this is the plot, that he wanted to make a reason for why our main characters are involved in this story. Mm-hmm. Again, if Superman has been there for 2 months, that means Clark has been there for 2 months. And after 2 months, he's the only person that he trusts in the entire Daily Planet organization. I don't know. It struck me as a little forced, but it had to be done, I think, to set up the story.
As far as the whole atmosphere that was being set, as far as the timeline, I was thinking back when you guys were mentioning this, when Bryan Singer was talking about Superman Returns and some of those early video things that he was doing, the little clips that he did that were video downloads you could download from iTunes. Mm-hmm. One of the things he mentioned about the art style that he used for it, he said he was looking for a very timeless quality to it, where it would have some of those throwbacks to classic clothing and styling, but by the same token, you'd have modern technology. So when you saw the film, at no point in time could you really place what era it was in. It would be kind of timeless. So, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering if maybe that's what they were going for in this, in the sense that you'd have this modern technology mixed in with the old style clothing and just that atmosphere to kind of again give it that timeless look. I don't know. I'm throwing it out there because I know he mentioned that as something he was going for. So I'm wondering if maybe that was a philosophy they used when they were developing this.
I guess I can understand where you're coming from there. That way, when you pick this up 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it'll still have that same feel. You know, it won't feel outdated if, you know, people are wearing, clothing that you would certainly expect to find people in 2006 to be wearing as opposed to, you know, stuff like this. So I can understand where you're coming from, but at the same time, it still leaves me wondering, you know, when the hell is this taking place and how old is Superman supposed to be in 2006 if this is taking place years ago? So I don't know. Maybe this is just the aesthetic value of Metropolis. Like you're talking about, Singer was saying.
Well, we always have, I mean, I don't know if we always seem to have this kind of like sliding 10-year scale of DC backstory here where it just, you know, there is no time or place. It just sort of is about 10 years ago is when this took place, no matter when you read it, no matter when you start. I think that's, like I said, to me it seems like kind of the way that a lot of people have gone with the design of the cities is kind of that mix of the new and the old and that whole, like I said, a Batman animated series, Superman animated series kind of feel to it. So it's kind of a strange mixture. I guess it didn't bother me per se, but it is a little strange to see like these newsroom wise guys in there.
Well, at the same time though, I love the interpretation of Perry White because he's always got to feel like that man who's in charge, and he certainly does feel like that here. I mean, with a line like Metropolis, she's the story, and then later on, the city of tomorrow, the question is, who's tomorrow? You know, this is Perry White here, always looking for a story, always looking to try and protect that city that he's been living in all these years and reporting on all these years. It makes perfect sense for him to feel like this when, you know, somebody's sort of invading that might be a bit shady. So that's the best part of the sequence for me. Perry is perfect.
This is kind of funny because I was more along the lines with Lois when she's like, give me a break. What do you? It's very dramatic. What do you actually want us to do? I don't know.
And it goes back to what you said, that we haven't seen Gallo actually do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So because of that, we really needed motivation. At this point, Perry provides it. He's the one that's saying that, you know, there's that vice, the prostitution, the drugs, and all hidden by that Las Vegas-like glamour with hotels, with rides, and art galleries, and restaurants, and that gambling. But he said, there's more going on here, and I need you to prove it. And that's what he's going for there. And I think at this point in the story, we really needed some motivation as to why are they even looking at Gallo? Because we haven't really seen anything that would make us say, this is somebody, like, why should we care that they're looking at him? And Perry provides that in the story. If we didn't have this here, I think at this point we would be having a very different opinion on what's going on in this story so far.
Yeah.
See, I kind of like the fact that they introduced this guy as the villain, not by having him do some nefarious, you know, murdering, you know, thousands of people or doing something that you as the reader sees what he's done. you're going into it just as blind as the characters are. You don't know what he's up to. You don't know what... You have your suspicions, but you're going to go along with the investigation as they're discovering it. You, as the reader, are going to discover it. And that's why I really like that whole sequence with Perry assigning them, and then they're setting up shop, watching the casino and everything. That was kind of cool for me.
Man, another nut from Jim there. Brilliant.
That's like three nuts you've got.
Three nuts to match his three thumbs. It makes sense.
But yeah, that's a good idea. That is a good point, because we don't know. You know, we're blindly going on Perry's word, just like Clark and Lois and Jimmy are, that we don't know why he's bad, other than just the fact that Perry has said he is.
Yeah, although I gotta say, I have never seen the three, Jimmy, Lois, and Clark, look more badass than on that one panel where they're all standing there, and Jimmy, of all people, goes, "You figured right, Chief," and then Lois, "Just tell us what to do," and Clark's just sort of like, "Where am I?"
See, Jimmy cannot look badass to me. I don't care what he's doing.
Especially with that Newsboy Legion hat on.
Yeah. Oh, please, yeah, and the freckles, the perfectly placed freckles, and the nose. What the hell? I don't know. This is Sale's signature here, so I can understand it, but he has the most squirrely nose in this
it's a
scene.
Pug nose, come on.
Yeah.
He's an east side of Metropolis tough scrapper. He's like one of the Bowery boys.
I guess. But they had to find a way to set these three up to be the main, you know, plot driven, you know, of, okay, we're going to go after this person, because obviously these are the three people in the DC universe that you know, so obviously this is who you're going for, but at the same time, the timeline just doesn't hold up to have all three of these people there at the same time. You know, if Clark's only been there 3 months or 2 months or whatever it is, you're not going to send him in on a huge story like this unless you really, really trust him. And unless he's done a lot in those 3 months, why would you trust him at this point?
One thing about Perry, though, Perry is, even though, yes, he's the editor, he is still a reporter at heart, and mm-hmm. a reporter trusts their instinct. So Perry's going to trust his instincts that this, you know, farm boy from Kansas is going to be a straight egg, you know, honest, you know, true blue, all-American boy, and he's going to trust him. Especially, you know, if they're going with the story how Clark got the exclusive interview with Superman, if they're going through that, how he got the job.
Yeah.
So you figure this is a guy who's friends with Superman or who had connections to Superman, so you can probably trust this guy.
Well, and you got to remember, they're operating completely off of Perry's instincts anyway, mm-hmm. because this whole utopia right. thing is based off of his instincts. He's got no proof. He wants them to find it. So that actually what you're saying actually kind of fits for everything that is going on right now, because it's all based off Perry's intuition, which we hope it leads to something.
If he has bad intuition here, I mean, that would really, really suck. You know, well,
it leads to two different outcomes, because really, right now, you know, you either have a choice, and this maybe sounds blindingly obvious, but either have the choice of, you know, are they gonna have this idea where at the beginning we suspect him and then he turns out to be a villain? Because that's gonna be kind of, I don't know, not really surprising if that happens. I guess so. Then you have the only other option is the fact that, okay, well, we all think he's a villain, but then he turns out to not be a villain. But then that makes Perry look kind of dumb, so I don't know. Which way do you guys think that's going
to
go?
I don't want this to turn out to be it like Luther was the real villain in this whole thing, and this guy wasn't. Just because I think Luther is becoming so overused.
Okay.
And I love Lex Luthor as a villain, but there comes a point where it's like, does every story of Superman have to have Lex Luthor as the villain, whereas, you know, maybe Anthony Gallo isn't the most developed villain, but I mean, at least they're trying to
right.
kind of come at it, you know, from the casino end versus the Lex Corp end at this time, and I don't know.
Well, isn't that what, I mean, like, as far as the other Tim Sale, at least the Tim Sale Batman projects are more like, more about crime,
yeah,
and organized crime and that kind of stuff, other than just simply superheroics. So, you know, maybe he's working some of that in there as well.
And they are more grounded in the real world.
And you know what? The one thing, too, Sean, I think that's interesting that you mentioned that, because we talked about this before when we were talking about the sequel to the Superman Returns film, is that, you know, for comic nerds like us, Superman has a lot of villains, but he has a really pathetic rogues gallery. I mean, once you get beyond Lex Luthor, I mean, who's next on the ladder? You know, it's not like Batman where you have 5, 6, 7, 8 really actual A-list villains
mm-hmm.
to bring against them. You know, you get beyond Luthor and then you start going, well, I don't know, these other guys are kind of sort of, you know, lame, I guess, on some levels. So
and Bizarro's kind of a joke, and you got Doomsday's been kind of done.
Ugh,
like, they've really told that story. And
yeah, what can you do? Every time he comes back, he kills him. Yeah, it's kind of a one-shot villain.
Yeah, once you start off and the first thing you ever do is kill the character, then you're done. There's really nothing else you can tell about the guy. So.
But they fleshed out the Doomsday story and kind of added new twists to it, but it's kind of like it reached a logical conclusion almost. And
yeah.
I think they've almost written themselves with Doomsday to the point where it would be very hard to use him again. I'm not saying they can't. You know, the right writer might be able to come up with something great, but he's not going to be like a regular appearing villain. He's going to be one that, like, if he comes in, it's going to be some random out of the blue thing versus a, we're going to see, like, 5 issues down the road, we're going to see another Doomsday story, and then he's going to be put into prison and he's going to come back out again. We're not going to see that with Doomsday.
Yeah. And also, we're also going to see him, you know, be intelligent one time and then not intelligent the next, because writers love doing that with Doomsday. I had to mention that. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. I mean, but that's what I'm saying. With what they've done with him now, with, like, you know, they made him intelligent and then they did that, they've kind of written him in such a way that it's like, what are you going to do with him now?
Yeah. Well, also, going back to the story, the next page after that maybe badass three-person shot, I was humming the A-Team's theme the entire time I'm looking at this here, with them setting it up and, you know, Lois doing the whole, like, you know, slide against the desk thing to pick up some papers. And I don't know why. It's just that's what it screamed to me right there. You know, the whole,
she,
like,
is kind of like the Face Man character from A-Team.
Oh, my God, you're right. Yeah, right. But still, I mean, the whole setup thing did really feel like they were a well-oiled machine and all that, which is something that you got to see out of, you know, three people that were basically hand-picked by an editor. So they better work together well.
I see this. Perry's Hannibal. Jimmy's Murdoch. Clark would be B.A., I guess, just because of his size. And then Lois would be Face, because she's the one that's going in to kind of make time with the villain.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a fool who douses me in liquid nitrogen.
I ain't saving no plane, fool.
Nah, man.
Jeez.
I think we've driven that analogy to the ground.
Right. But no, at the same time, though, it is nice to see that teamwork aspect obviously playing a part here, because when you're on an assignment, you have to be a team in order to actually succeed. And you're definitely getting that in one page. Sale actually does that for us. And, you know, other people, it might take 4 or 5 pages. In one page, we get that feel, which was great. Okay.
Oh, do you want confirmation?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Great. And
also, genius.
Looking at.
We left also, you hanging.
Yeah, looking at Gallo now. By the way, he has a very Vandal Savage look to him.
And he's got a heavy, like, eyeliner look. So I mean, he's evil, bad, nasty guy with a goatee and dark circles around his eyes.
And the eyeliner obviously means that he's an 80s Eve kind of evil. So
he's an emo businessman. I'm waiting for next issue where it's revealed that he's like a, you know, he loves fluffy bunnies and gives children presents and dresses up as Santa Claus.
Maybe he is the same Anthony Gallo.
Oh, jeez. Worst running gag ever.
Well, I mean, this is taking place in the past. Do we know what he's doing now?
Right. Well, he does have an earring, so, I mean...
Oh, yeah, that must be true. He must be gay.
Right, exactly.
Wait, hold on. Now, with all due respect, mm-hmm. just because he stars in the movies doesn't mean he actually is.
That's true. Just a paycheck.
Right. Anyway.
So, can we...
You're starting to scare me here.
Can we get
Sean
Whalen
can we get
has
around
officially...
to that last panel, then?
We're getting there. We got about another 2 pages until we're there, but I actually just wanted to comment quickly on this. They did do a good job of making him at least seem badass with that one line of, I don't know, have some celebrity killed or find a two-headed kitten. Anything to make those idiots in the media move on to the next shiny thing. That's some good line right there.
Well,
that's
and
a
that
damn
actually,
good line.
We needed that too because of a lot of the discussion we've been having. Because that paints him as a villain.
Yeah.
Because up until then, again, we've got that question mark, like, is Luther doing this to him or what? But when you get a line like that, that's not a guy who is, like, you know, a nice man. He really meant for them to just do whatever they needed to make this go away.
Well, or is he just speaking, like, metaphorically? And I don't necessarily think he's ordering that they go out and kill some starlet to his thugs, even though they do look pretty goonish in the background there.
But I think he was implying that it doesn't matter what you have to do, make this stop.
I guess. Yeah, Jim, is he implying that to you, that he's going out there to, you know, kill some celebrity, or is that just, you know, rich man talk?
I see that as just, you know, kind of like a figure of speech. Just get it done, whatever it takes, by any means necessary.
Right.
This is kind of a confirmation to some of the Perry's instincts that this is an evil guy right there. He's, you know, do whatever it takes. Kill a celebrity, I don't care. Find, you know, whatnot that you gotta do.
And I honestly didn't see this as him going out to kill a celebrity like the Olsen twins from the
Full House.
Yeah. No, I really meant in the sense that he was really saying, you've got license to do whatever is necessary. And that's where I guess I needed that at that point, because I'm with you. I haven't seen yet, like, where this guy is a creep. And this made me say, okay, maybe Perry's onto something.
I guess so, yeah. And we get a classic Lois line on the next page with Clark and her on the phone. Clark asking Lois, is that you? And Lois, well, that's quite a question, Clark. I mean, are any of us really us in this crazy, mixed-up world of ours? Can anyone truly say, Lois?
For some reason, I actually found that annoying. I don't know why.
Lois has been portrayed like that in the past. She's very smarmy, you know, especially with, you know, quote-unquote Smallville. You know, she loves playing with him a little bit, and that's what I get there. It's just, you know, it's just Lois being Lois.
I love the panel with Clark with the sly grin, though, because you get the impression, like, either a couple things are happening there. Either he genuinely likes her teasing him, or he kind of got it, even though he was pretending he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, to hold the whole, like, I'm a dunce kind of thing as he was going through. But sure. I like that, because you kind of wonder, what's going through his head right there? Because it shows some, like, thought there. And I don't know if that was deliberate. I might be reading into it. But he's got, like, a little sly, smirky grin on his face right there.
Yeah.
I think he's saying, wow, I really want to marry you someday.
Yeah, I can buy into that, too.
You know, like that's it. Wow, damn, I have one fine woman here. And, you know, maybe someday I'll actually let her know that, you know, this person that she's, you know, being sarcastic with is also the same person she's dining with on the Eiffel Tower.
So, man, right, all in that smile. That's exactly what you get out of it.
Oh, exactly, exactly. I'm not reading into anything. No, of course not. But the next panel we actually have, the next scene, you see the disappointment, even without, you know, actually seeing much from him, just that one, you know, little frown we get from Clark on the fact that, you know, because he's on this stakeout, he can't save people from that volcano. Which proves, again, Superman can't be everywhere at once, no matter how much he wants to be.
He could have just made some excuse that he was going out for a sandwich or something.
Or like from the Action Comics, I have a dentist appointment, I'll see you later.
There you go.
You know?
A big gulp to make it very 80s.
Oh, exactly, right.
So that way we'll add another era into the story to make it further timeless.
Right, sure. Oh, wait, I forgot. I have a screening ticket to see Short Circuit. Just to get the 80s reference in there. But no, I mean, you definitely do get that feeling that, you know, it goes with the vulnerability of Clark and as Superman, that he can't be everywhere at once and save everybody. That this, you know, even though this world might have a savior, he's not going to be able to save everybody.
That's what really did make this a total joy for me, though, that whole development of his insecurities. Because I think that good writers know how to make this character accessible. It's a great character, Superman. I think sometimes, though, writers feel that you've got to make him this overpowering alien that you can't relate to. He can still be that guy, while at the same time you see the farm boy. And I think the people who understand the farm boy part of him that gets in there too really make this, he's an endearing character.
Without a doubt, because, I mean, you got to play him right, though. You know, if you play Clark with pretty much the exact same personality as Superman, then you're losing something there. They have to be two different characters with almost, you know, two entirely different personalities, yet, you know, linked together. Because that's what they are. They're two sides of the same coin.
He becomes a cold fish, then. You know, there's no relating to him.
But, you know, I don't think that that's really that much different than ever since the relaunch after the original Crisis. I think that's pretty much the same tack that they've been taking with the character. I do agree that we don't often see any of these characters' thought processes, I guess. And it's sort of interesting to see him be concerned for his safety. But ultimately, we know as the reader that he is not going to be harmed by anything except for this kryptonite, which we are building towards the confrontation with.
And we do have, finally, Matt, guess what? We have the last scene here, finally.
Okay. That was my initial read-through. I was like, okay, what the hell was that supposed to mean?
Now, no, hold on, wait. Now, Jim hasn't caught it yet, so I want Jim, if he has the page, I want him to open up to that last page and look specifically at Gallo holding the phone. What do you see? this will be great if he actually catches it. Because
okay, he's got a ring with kryptonite in it.
Ding! We have a winner.
So yeah, we're supposed to, I guess that's what we're supposed to assume. Now, question then comes up, you know, because Luthor has always been the guy with the kryptonite ring. Now, is this the same ring that Luthor is eventually going to end up with? Is this just a totally different coincidence? What's this going to mean? Obviously, if that is a kryptonite ring, that Superman will be foiled by Gallo and his presence in some way in the future issue. So, I don't know. Any of those questions you guys want to try to answer?
I think it's going to be accidental. I don't think Gallo necessarily realizes that what he's got. With Superman being so early in there. But I think that is going to be an interesting story tactic. The Luthor being a part of this, I think you're right. This could be how Luthor gets the ring.
Yeah.
It seems like it might be kind of far-fetched, but again, I mean, to have two different rings that are exactly the same would be even more far-fetched.
Oh, so. Of course, yeah.
Unless they use the same jeweler.
It's possible.
I'm totally kidding. I'm with you. I think that this would actually be a good origin story for the ring itself, because it would be nice to see where that came from.
Definitely, because we've never really seen that, if I remember correctly, unless there was actually an explanation
forged. If my memory serves me correctly, there was a mention of that made in the Burn relaunch, and I can't remember if it's in Man of Steel or if it was in his Superman or Action, but there was a point where Luthor unveiled this ring that he had found. So I'm not sure if that's a change of the origin or if they're going to go with that or how that works. But at this point, I mean, we're so far removed from that, you know, continuity is...
Yeah, well, also, I mean, they really aren't really going back and talking about a lot of stuff that happened in Burn anymore. You know, in Burn's Man of Steel, they've sort of been sort of shying away from that as of late, especially with some of the, you know, retellings and, you know, changes that they've made in the past with some of the new origin stuff that came out that sort of go in the complete opposite direction of what Burn had done. So I guess maybe that is just a story that's been left in the past, and we're getting a new origin for pretty much everything now.
And I believe that. I believe that they said that even Birthright, which would be the more recent origin, I believe that they consider that to not be the origin anymore. That there is, because of, you know, what happened with New Earths and everything, that none of the origins are considered the same. So that would fit.
Now, the fact that Gallo is looking at that paper with Lois, and it looks like it is an article about Superman, unless it's obviously something else. But, oh, wait, no, actually, hold on here. Let's see. Yeah, it could be about Superman. Yeah, exactly. So
whatever that means.
Yeah, it could be talking about Gallo. It could be talking about Superman. I mean, if he was the guy behind the Royal Flush Gang, he might want to get to somebody who obviously is associated with Superman and has written about him. But at the same time, it could just be that she wrote an article about him, and that's why he wants her there. I mean, who knows? It could be
or did you take it that he saw the picture, and
that's
he wants
how
her there
it.
Because of the picture?
That's how I took it. He's like, man, she's hot. I'm going to do my thing here.
Yeah,
because, I mean, she's had that, like, I mean, Luthor was very taken with her, you know, during the early years. This would be very fitting to Lois during this time, in the sense that, you know, she was the sexy woman reporter who's also got that intelligence about her that makes her, like, very intriguing. Like, she's the one that they want to catch, but is a hard to be a catch, if that makes sense.
Hmm. You think that they're, because this came to my mind, and since they're messing with the origins to some way, do you think that they're, on some levels, they're kind of making this Gallo play the part that some of what Lex Luthor did in the Man of Steel or those early issues?
Well, it's certainly possible, since, I mean, as Sean has mentioned in the past, that, you know, he is a bit played out at this point, Lex. You know, he's everywhere. So it might be kind of a good idea to maybe, you know, put this guy in that position and maybe, you know, play that out. Plus, also, I really don't see Lois falling for Lex at any point, you know, with her personality now. And this might be a bit, you know, shallow right here, but I don't think she'd really fall for the, you know, bald, slightly chubby type. Because, I mean, she falls for freaking Superman. You know, she was looking for that gruff and tough guy. I don't know if Lex is really going to fit that role.
Well, but he's, you know, the way that they had portrayed him in that relaunch is that he was a, you know, very powerful, rich guy with a lot of charisma on some level, so.
But I think what's fitting about this, though, it's not that Lois is seeking them. It's that they're seeking Lois. Mm-hmm. Like, if you remember, even in the Man of Steel revamp, where when Byrne did the balding Lex, he was actively seeking out Lois Lane. And in this case, it would make sense that Gallo would be actively seeking her out, at least from that standpoint. And also, I agree, though, you can even throw in the element that he may want to use her reporter end of it, you know, as somebody on that inside to be able to have control of.
He's also looking for, you know, good press, too. So, you know, she's just another tool for him to get good press for his casino.
And she also said that she was looking for him to get more balanced coverage. So that could certainly be one of the factors for her, for, you know, him actually granting her the time. So, I mean, you really don't know at this point exactly what's going to happen. And that's why I kind of wanted a couple of extra pages to at least see, you know, what Lois's reaction was, or at least have a little bit of their conversation going on. Because when we got to that last page, I really was expecting more, and I didn't get it. So it's not a bad thing that I'm expecting more, because obviously that'll make me pick up issue two, but it did leave me a little bit in the lurch where it ended where it did. So I mean, that's what I'm thinking here, and obviously we went in that earlier. So,
and I got to admit, though, I want to see it. I want to see where they're going with this.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so do I. I mean, I'm definitely on there for issue two. I mean, is everybody in agreement that they'll be picking up issue two with us? Or?
Oh, yeah, picking up two.
Okay. All right, Matt, what about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm curious as far as where they're going to go with this. You know, it's interesting. Hopefully we'll get, you know, obviously, I just want to find out if it's, and make sure that it's not the damn rock. that's all I want to find out.
Yeah, because again,
that would ruin this for me. Actually, yeah. if the rock itself, I'm being totally honest here. If the rock is the thing that's having the conversation with us, and there's nothing inside there, I got a huge problem with that.
Yeah, especially since his movies lately really haven't been that good. So
weak. But you know, I just thought of this, though. Actually, here's another twist on this. Now, you know that more recently, and in Smallville and other things, we've gotten this idea that crystals are somehow like computers.
Mm-hmm.
That may be interesting if somehow this is like a chunk of some kind of, you know, Kryptonian computer or something.
Like that. I don't know. I don't know if I'm quite looking for that. I think I'm looking more for a big baddie to pop out of there, or at least somebody like the
Eradicator. Well, that would make sense to me.
I would be okay with what Matt's saying, though, if it's like a computer inside that rock.
Mm-hmm.
Like inside the, I don't want the kryptonite to be the computer. But, I mean, I get what you're saying. You're saying, what if it's, like, part of some Kryptonian crystals, or it fits that whole thing? I just don't want to introduce into the DC Universe talking kryptonite.
Yeah. No, of course, yeah. I mean, the kryptonite man is silly enough in the first place. I mean, to have talking kryptonite would just be even worse.
Come on, you can have the little ring. The ring is the one that's behind our plants.
Oh, no.
It's just green in his ear.
Yeah,
take
great.
Over the casino.
But then doesn't that make like Metallo like the ventriloquist then? Because there's going to be like the talking kryptonite inside him, and
it could be interesting. There he goes.
Dear God, don't let us go down this path. Please, please, for the love of Pete, don't let it happen.
Yeah. Do me a favor though, and turn to that page where they show the kryptonite rock sticking out of the ground.
Yeah,
does that not look like a body?
Huh?
There's like on the top of it. There's two eye holes, a nose, a mouth. And you can see, like, two pectorals, and then, like, arms, an arm and a hand.
It looks like an abominable small man. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it does actually look a little bit like that. On the next scene, it's not really there, but on that one, yeah, I can certainly see what you're talking about. That actually does lead me to believe now it could actually be Eradicator. Because hasn't Eradicator had many different forms since he's actually been on Earth?
Yeah, I think he took Superman's form because Superman died.
Yeah.
That was the reason why went into that form, but that wasn't... He was more... I don't know why I want to say energy-based. I don't remember. I clearly remember during the Return of Superman, that whole storyline where he, you know, took on Superman's form. But I can't remember what his form was before that. But it definitely wasn't the same form as Clark.
Let's see here. I actually have his origin via Wikipedia ready to roll here. So, in the distant past, a dying alien race created a number of devices to preserve their culture and sent them into space where they would encounter other civilizations and link their colonies. When a small group of these aliens arrived on Krypton, a militaristic faction led by Kem-El killed them and corrupted one of their devices to preserve his ideal of Kryptonian culture. The device would eradicate alien influences and hence he called it the Eradicator. That sounds a bit like what the narration was talking about in those first pages.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could fit.
Huh. Yeah, now I'm leaning a bit more towards Eradicator, now that I've actually read that, because it would actually, I guess it would make a little bit of sense there, but it doesn't say anything about him being, you know, Kryptonite or anything like that. Maybe he's just inside of Kryptonite, and then, you know, when he breaks out, it's going to, you know, scatter it across the globe or something like that. I don't know. I mean, I'm grasping at straws here as to why he would actually be inside Kryptonite. See,
I like that, though. I like that we don't know right now. Mm-hmm. It's the reveal that is going to be the make or break it point. You know, like I said, it'll be a major letdown if it's a talking rock. I want to be something.
Golly gee whiz, you think?
Well, they had Pet Rock, so this could be another tie into another era.
All right, look. Streaky the Super Cat was bad enough, all right? I don't need talking Kryptonite. Thank you very much. All right, at this point, we've got the Confidential series and all that. I want to ask the important question here. After reading this issue, do you feel that the Confidentials are necessary in the DC universe right now? Do you feel that they're actually proving their worth? Obviously, we've only seen the first one so far, so is Superman Confidential proving that it should be there, as opposed to, say, happening in another one of the, you know, in the books, or maybe in just like a quick annual format? What are you thinking here? Because obviously they have the classifieds and stuff with JLA and JSA. You could probably put an individual story inside of there, as opposed to its own Superman book. What's Superman Confidential doing for you so far?
I think this has the potential to be like Legends of the Dark Knight to Batman.
Okay.
And Legends of the Dark Knight's had a number of wonderful Batman stories in there. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is, but it's had, especially in the early run of it, there was some phenomenal stuff coming out of that. You know, if you put the right creators on this and you tell some great stories, I do think it's kind of limiting for them to be all first meetings and all that. So I'm hoping that they eventually, I'm not saying that that's not cool in the beginning of it. Yeah. I'd like to see a lot of that. But I think there's going to come some point where they're going to need to break away from that, because that's going to get old. Right. There's a lot of things you can do right now to keep it fresh and keep doing that, but there's going to come a point, if this is going to continue to be an ongoing, where they're going to want to break that formula and just tell different Superman stories told by great creators. I agree with what Matt was, I think, trying to touch on this before when he was mentioning we've got the All-Star line, now we've got this. I don't know, now that we've got the All-Star line, that we need to keep adding these type of books in there. The only difference would be is the All-Star line is blatantly out of continuity, where this is, I'm guessing, more in continuity.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is that the impression you guys get from this. This is meant to be something that takes place actually within continuity, or?
I would say so. That's what they're leaning towards so far. This does actually feel like something that could actually fit into, you know, modern day storytelling, as opposed to the Silver Age esque stuff we're getting out of the All Star, or the goddamn Batman that we're getting out of All Star Batman.
You know, the thing with this, again, kind of what Sean said, is part of, I think, the problem with a book like this is just that it's confusing to have all these different branches and confidentials and classifieds and all these other kind of things. It seems like it kind of clutters up the market. If they don't have a very definitive plan, if it doesn't have a definitive identity for what the purpose of this book is,
mm-hmm.
I think it's going to get lost in the shuffle. And if they, you know, what I see this as being is, if this is going to be in continuity, we're going to see this used as major way to overhaul a lot of continuity for these two characters, because, you know, if they're going to focus on all these, like you said, you know, first meetings, basically then every main villain, every big event is going to be retold through mm-hmm. these different lenses, and that's totally going to change, you know, basically everything that we know about these characters. So, you know, if we're going to get in, you know, like in Batman, you know, if we're going to get like the first meeting of the Joker, we're going to get the first meeting of this guy or that guy, it's going to be, you know, like the 20th time that we've seen these different origins for the different meetings of these different characters. I'm hoping it's not going to turn into that. And again, I don't really see the point of having both All-Star and these confidential books. So All-Star, go away.
Well, how about Batman Confidential at the same time as what Sean just previously mentioned with Batman? I mean, there's no reason to have two of those now. Get rid of one of them.
That's going to be interesting how we feel about that when we review that, because you guys are coming over our way for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious to see, because I read all of Legends of the Dark Knight, so that is a book that I get regularly, and I really enjoy that book. That's one I'm really questioning, like, why do we need Batman Confidential if we have that? And I'm just going to be curious to see, going on the theme that these are all first meetings, I do see that as something that could potentially be very limiting or get old fast. I don't know.
Jim, has Superman Confidential proven its worth for you after this one issue here? I mean, do you feel that there's a reason for it? Yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed this, you know, and I'm looking forward to number two and seeing what happens. Now, this is something I think I could get bored with very quickly if, when I'm reading them, the stories do not keep me enthralled and don't keep me going. Whereas the ongoing series, I'm more likely to be more forgiving and just, okay, I'll work through a couple bad story arcs before I drop it. Mm-hmm. This one, you get a couple bad issues. I wouldn't feel too bad dropping this because this isn't current continuity.
Sure.
This is like an Elseworld to me.
Okay. All right. So that you don't feel that this fits into current continuity, what you're saying. This is just like All-Star.
Yeah, that's what this feels like to me.
But I think that's the thing, is if, I don't know if it's DC's intent, I mean, is this stuff supposed to be the new continuity? And if it is, then that has a big difference. I think that's a big difference on how you view the stories. Because if they are Elseworlds kind of like that, it doesn't really matter all that much what they do with it. If they make a Kryptonite talk, you know, it's stupid, but that's not going to affect the main line. If this is in continuity, then that those changes are going to have much more, you know, a bigger impact on the rest of the stories.
Yeah.
And if it isn't in continuity, going again on what Matt was saying, why isn't it an All-Star? Why aren't we just saving that for an All-Star story? Why do we need it in this? I'm taking this as this is continuity. Because otherwise, I'm again going to say, why didn't they just save this and Darwin Cook, Tim Sale, All-Star Superman after the Grant Morrison run's done?
Well, again, they don't know how long that's going to last. They don't know how long it's going to take for that stuff to come out. Exactly. I mean, especially with Batman. If you waited for All-Star Batman and Robin to come out to put Batman Confidential after that, good luck with that. you'll have a story coming out, as Matt just said, in 2010, 2012. So, you know, have something that comes out regularly. And that could be one of the reasons why these things even exist in the first place. For all we know, these could have been stories that were going to be told after that. Because all the other ones are all, wait, you know, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So, who knows? This might have been a last-second decision to make these titles in the first place. We just don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
One of the questions that I have from this, and it was one of the things I actually put on my notes, how is this different than the classified books?
Hmm.
Because I'm reading both JLA and JSA Classified. And again, same thing I said about Legends of Dark Knight. Some of the stories I'm really enjoying in those. Other one, it's hit and miss. You know, there's hit stories in there depending on the creative team. And there's some miss stories on there. And I'm sure we could probably go around and stories that I loved, you probably hated. And stories that you loved, I might not have gotten attached to. I don't know why this isn't called Superman Classified. Going on what Matt's saying about the different branding, I think this is going to become a very confusing thing for DC because we're doing multiple brands, and we're not sure what those brands mean.
Well, you know what? At this point, I'd say this first issue here felt more like a JSA Confidential than a JLA Confidential. Because JSA has had more character stories, while JLA has more team stories that have been going along, you know, the different years in continuity. JSA Classified, from what I've seen so far, has pretty much been going on at the exact same time as JSA, while JLA Classified has not. So, I don't know, it's really confusing to think about, because on one side, it's more character-based like JSA. On the other side, it's out of continuity, you know, like different parts of continuity like JLA is doing. So maybe that's why they decided to just make it a confidential as opposed to a classified to, you know, not have to worry about the comparisons and just have their own line. I don't know.
Man, I'm confused. I'm not a stupid person generally. There's so many titles, and it's almost kind of getting to the point somewhat with the way that Marvel has done with their books, with all these different things where you have, you know, Marvel Knights this and all these different branch offs that don't really have their own specific identities.
Yeah.
You know, having this series be about firsts is kind of an identity, I guess. But it's, you know, that'll, like you said, that'll get old kind of fast if that's all we get from the stories.
Yeah, I guess so. So they're going to have to keep it good for us to keep reading it, or else then bye-bye.
depending on the creator, I mean, certain creators, I'm sure, you know, they're rotating creators, they can hit home run stories and make firsts interesting. It's just going to be a hard sell to keep this going this way. I'm liking this first issue, and I'm definitely going to be interested in finishing this arc. I want to see where this keeps going. I hope this one's a monthly, too. I'm getting tired of these books that are like bi-monthly or supposed to be bi-monthly and aren't bi-monthly. And I have a lot of patience for them, like especially with what they're doing with, like, you know, All-Star Superman. I'll be honest with you, whatever delays go on in that book, I'll keep getting it because I'm just liking it. I'm getting tired of the increasing list of books that are like that right now.
Well, Sean, I know that you'll appreciate this. I hear that the next group of people that's going to come on Superman Confidential once, you know, these guys are gone are going to be Chuck Austin and Rob Liefeld, so it'll be great.
Yeah. And we'll get the first appearance of Beppo the Super Monkey.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Wait, is that legit?
No, he's...
No! God, jeez. If it was legit, I would not be buying it. Simple as that.
You scared me there for a minute.
Well, for once, it wasn't Jim, so I'm just glad to actually pull something over your eyes.
You know why? The only reason why it even shook me for a second was considering the nature of this book. And I was just kind of like, and Liefeld has made appearances recently in the DC Universe on a book I really like.
Yeah, and it's the one issue of Teen Titans I still do not have. Oh. Part two of that, I could not bring myself to pick up. So
I picked him up for Gail Simone. Gail Simone writing. I love Gail Simone's writing. Yeah. Rob Liefeld did a good job of ruining that.
Mm-hmm. and by the way, speaking of Gail Simone, God damn you, Sean. God damn you, sir. All right, I like Gen 13 number one. God damn you.
Oh, Gen 13 number one's awesome.
Yeah, I know. And God damn you. That's all I'm saying. I wasn't going to pick that up, man, until you gave it that ringing endorsement on Raging Bullets. And I'm like, all right, fine, whatever. And then I liked it, and now I'm like, crap. Where's number two?
The Windstorm stuff I've been reading so far has been really good, and I even said it on the show. I'm like, I wanted this stuff to be crap.
Yeah, you and me both, man. You and me both. But let's get to some of the forum comments that were left here. First of all, from Nightwing BK, and he's got a very simple comment here. A lot of meh for me. When I asked him to explain himself, he said, maybe I should just hold off and drive you nuts. And he never posted anything else, so he's driving me nuts here. So
Is that the one where I called him an evil man afterwards?
Yeah.
I responded to that.
Yeah, and Nightwing BK, buddy, answer me, man. This actually is driving me nuts here. I got to know what you didn't like about this. So
all he thinks he's on an episode of Comic Time, and suddenly he can play with our emotions.
Hey, two episodes, so...
You bastard.
And he's been on Raging Bullets, so...
Yeah,
this
he's
dude,
been a couple times on Raging Bullets. He's done some great audio comments for us as well that he sent in, so...
Yeah, and I gotta listen to his Nightwing one once we're done here, because I'm almost done with 31. I'm getting there. But we got a comment here from LT Smash. When I first saw this, I was extremely excited. Darwin Cook's DC New Frontier is one of my favorite books, along with the various Tim Sale, Jeff Loeb collaborations, Long Halloween, etc. Now I was a little conflicted, because Cook was just writing the book, not drawing, and Tim Sale was working on something not written by Jeff Loeb. After having read Superman Confidential number 1, I'm very pleased and looking forward to the rest of the series. So I can see what LT Smash is talking about here, because Sale has pretty much just been with Loeb for years now. I don't remember a just Sale book coming out in a very long time now. So this is the first time that we've really seen him working with anybody else. So I can understand his skepticism there at first.
Did you read the issue of Solo that Tim Sale was involved in, the DC series Solo?
I still have to go back and pick up Solo through the dollar bins at New York Comic Con. I actually haven't read any.
I highly recommend that series. He had an issue of Solo, and that was one where you're paired up with different, you know, it's the artist paired up with different writers, or some of them are just the artists doing their own work. Mm-hmm. That would be one I'd highly recommend seeking out if you want to see Sale doing with different creators. There is a story in there with Jeff Loeb, but I'm almost positive. I think it was set in the universe that they've already created, if I remember correctly. Okay. He was like the first issue, I believe. And it's definitely worth seeking out for people who are interested in more of his stuff outside of that.
Yeah, well, I'll have to remember that, actually, because I've been meaning to pick up Solo, because I know that Neil Gaiman had had one story that was told in there, so I'll have to...
Well, I mean, there's... I haven't seen all of those, but there's a few gems. The Paul Pope issue is good. The Mike Allred one is probably my favorite. If you haven't read that one, it's awesome.
Hey, Jim, go ahead and pick it up. I know that you're not picking up enough comics right now.
Yeah, I know.
Sean, did you read... Have you read that one before?
The Mike Allred one?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I got the whole series all the way through. I liked the whole thing.
That issue to me, I don't know, that was the one I liked the most, just because it's, I'm kind of more of an older school guy, and I appreciate the crazy Silver Age kind of stories more, and that the Teen Titans story that he had in the back of that book is just awesome.
Mike Allred's stuff is incredible, anyway. Did you see about the Madman Gargantua that's coming, just as long as we're on Mike Allred?
Oh, no, I used to be a big Madman fan, but I haven't kept up with it lately.
Newsarama just had an article, just because we're talking about him. They're releasing all of his Madman stuff in one gigantic 825-page volume.
Oh, my God.
Extras that it's coming out. I think it's like $125, but for anybody that's buying on the net, that's one you can pre-order it. And usually the 40 to 50% off usually on those hardcovers. If you didn't touch this Madman stuff, it's
I have a lot of his original work. He, and I don't mean to offend anyone, but he sort of kind of lost me once he started doing his Mormon religion comics instead of Madman. So I don't know. I'd like to see him do more actual mainstream work.
And I'm sure you'll be able to find all that stuff at comichole.com, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Cha-ching, cha-ching. Yeah, we also have one here from a JLA fan. This is definitely not Tim Sale's best artwork. I think he must have a lot of work on his plate right now, and this just seemed kind of rushed. Thicker line work than in Superman for All Seasons in any event. This is more in line with this more current work, like on Catwoman When in Rome. But while the thicker lines and darker artwork worked for me in Batman-related stories, I like his Superman stuff to be a bit lighter and airier. Again, I would contrast to For All Seasons. And what's up with the pencil-thin ankles he's giving Superman throughout the issue, including on the cover? The story was okay, but nothing that left me jonesing for issue number two. First issue was only 74 cents from DCBS, so I'm not out too much money. I suspect I'll let this one slide and maybe pick up the trade if the series as a whole gets really good buzz as it progresses. And that's JLA fan. I mean, what do you think about that statement there, that it's not Sale's best work? I mean, obviously, I mean, what I mentioned before, that it's not, you know, what I usually expect out of him, I guess that Bob here would agree with that. Anybody want to take that?
I would just say, considering both creators and their track record, both have been excellent storytellers involved with very big storylines. Even going back to Solo, as Matt was talking about, Darwin Cook did a great issue of Solo where the whole thing kind of integrated and overlapped all the way through. And I just, these two creators are two that I will give some leeway to, because I know that at the end of this thing, it's going to wind up being really good all the way through. I will agree, though, this first issue for me, it was not the kind of bang I was expecting from Tim Sale or Darwin Cook. I was left wanting more out of this issue, so I can see how he feels that way. Like, I still feel like, and I think we all touched on that, like a couple extra pages, a few extra panels, we were talking at the end, would have been something that we all needed. But I think because of the creators, I'm on board all the way through for this particular arc in Superman Confidential, because these two are great storytellers, and I think we're going to see it. I do think, and I'd like to know more about this, if they did the art together, because I think that might be why we're all getting kind of this unusual vibe with it.
Now, actually, now that I look at it, yeah, they are a bit pencil thin. It's not really what you would expect out of Tim Sale's ankles, because I'm looking at the cover now, and it looks like Parasite like sucked the muscle out of him in that one specific portion of his body. So I don't know. That's the one part that doesn't really look quite right for me, to tell you the truth. Everything else kind of does.
The art's not a huge selling point as much as the story, I guess, at this point. Whose signature is that on the cover?
That is Sale. Yeah, T. Sale, 2006.
Okay.
Yeah. That one's definitely Tim Sale.
So that's him by himself, and then the rest of this, we're assuming that there's some kind of a collaboration going on?
I'm assuming so, because, you know what? There's just T. Sale 2006 on the Superman when he has the truck. So, I don't know, maybe this is just Tim Sale, and he just, you know, put that at the end of the comic because... You know, because it was both their story? I don't know. I mean, it's a very good question to ask.
I'm searching the net right now, just because we've brought it up multiple times. I'm not seeing anything out of the two of them doing the art together.
Okay.
And that's, I just figured, because, I mean, this is an assumption that I'm just trying to throw out there because we were talking about the art. But everything I'm seeing gives art and cover credits to Tim Sale completely. So I'm guessing that is right, that it would be that they put that at the end just because both, Cook did the writing and Sale did the art as kind of a nod to both creators for their collaboration. So I'm not seeing anything.
But then why do they have the ambiguous credits in the story that they don't actually say who did what? They just decided that, well, I don't know, maybe they both came up with the story or...
Well, you know what? Actually, this isn't the first one to do that, actually. In Spider-Girl, all the time, it says DeFalco and Friends, however the hell you pronounce his name, storytellers. It doesn't say, which one does pencils and which one doesn't.
Well,
so.
And that is a collaboration between the artist and the writer anyway, because even though that Cook's doing the script, Sale is interpreting the script, so it is going to be that kind of collaboration. I'm trying to find anything that would show them doing combo art, and I don't see anything.
Well, hopefully one of them will be at New York Comic Con, and I'll be able to ask him that question, because this is actually going to irk me until I find out whether or not it was true or false or not. But we got John Mayo's comment here, which was applied to JLA fan. This is about where I'm at on this, too. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't exactly good either. As the first chapter of a story, it was okay, but didn't pull me in enough to stay with the story. As a single issue, it left me wanting more, and not in a good way. I don't have future issues on my DCBS order, nor do I see any need to add them. And that says something when John Mayo isn't picking up a comic.
You know, he wasn't picking up the Wildstorm stuff, but he was salivating so much at it at CGS that I had to give it to him.
Yeah, we talked about that actually on the last special episode that he was on, and he says he's going to leave you a nice happy comment eventually on this stuff. So that was great.
He's such a nice guy, Sean. He's such a swell guy.
Well, he turned back to me during the thing. He said, "I know I'm going to win that." Because, you know, it was the one thing that he wasn't reading. And he was like, yeah. "I'm glad I'm not reading it because I'm going to start picking it up if I do." So when I won it, I handed it right to him.
Well, I love what his reasoning was, too. I asked him, "Why aren't you picking it up?" He says, "Well, it's simple. I've never read it, so it can't be good." You know, he says it in a very amusing way. Like, "I'm not picking up any Wildstorm so I can say that I don't like it. You know, that'll be my explanation as to why I'm not picking it up." But guess what? Now he has those issues, so now he's not going to be able to say that. And you'll be getting a very big thank you, I'm sure, Sean.
This poor guy's going to get me back, I know. He's a hell of a nice guy.
He is. He definitely is, yeah. John's great to meet in person and to talk to on the forums and all that. And the Mayo Report keeps me amused every single time I listen to it.
And he's the sole reason why the Drawer Box people are still in business.
Exactly.
Wait, yeah. After seeing his drawer box collection, I bought drawer boxes. He should be getting commission from them.
Hey, well, I can tell you this, Sean. I used comichole.com after you guys talked about them enough. So right there, he should be getting something. John should be getting something from these dudes. So, because if you worked with Comic Hole, he definitely worked with drawer boxes. That's all I'm saying. and they are good people over at comichole.com, I have to say.
Oh, they've been awesome. I use them too. So I mean, I get their shipments, and they literally, if I order something, they're there the next week.
Yeah, I got Athena Voltaire number 2 from them recently, because I couldn't find it anywhere else, and in beautiful condition. You know, no problems with it whatsoever, and it was great stuff. So, and by the way, you guys are going to be at the New York Comic Con, right?
Oh, absolutely. We got a whole section of us there. It's going to be awesome.
In fact. Comic Timing is brought to you by the New York Comic Con. New York Comic Con is bigger, better, and has doubled the space with more gaming and anime for 2007. Come to the Jacob Javits Center February 23rd to 25th and experience the biggest pop culture event in New York City, featuring comics, anime, manga, graphic novels, video games, trading card games, RPG, MMOs, toys, movies, TV, celebrities, and more. Guests of honor include Tim Sale, Jeff Smith, J. Michael Straczynski, and George Perez, and many more to be announced. In fact, if you go to their website, they just announced a whole bunch more people that are involved. Don't have it up right now, but there are a lot more people there. So for a complete list of guests as well as show information, visit mycomiccon.com. Buy your tickets online now to ensure your spot for the 2007 show. Tickets are available now at a discounted rate for advanced purchases at mycomiccon.com. You can also book your travel arrangements online now on the travel page of the website. Don't miss out on the 2007 New York Comic Con. Visit our website to get all the information you need. And I am definitely looking forward to that, without a doubt. And it'll be fun to collaborate with all the different podcasts that are going to be there. And it's great stuff. And I'm glad that they're actually, you know, sponsoring everybody like this. It's really, really nice of them to have a podcast arena, you know, where we can battle to the death.
Well, you know what it is? The great thing about the podcast arena is it's a great chance for us to just get out there. The podcasts are out there.
Yeah,
there's just a whole bunch of people that are enjoying comics that don't know that podcasts are available, and really the podcast community now is just as diverse as the comics are. So it's
which is
great though. I mean, because there's something out there for everybody. So it's going to be a great opportunity for all of us to just get, you know, hooked down to some listeners.
And I love that name. I love that podcast arena name, because all I can think of in my head is, you know, the battle to the death, man.
Cue the Star Trek music.
Oh, Ian, you're not going to fight in the middle of the floor.
Oh, God.
He's going to be in there with his bow staff, with his shirt off.
Bow staff? I live in Brooklyn, man.
The, Tom Caters or something.
Where the hell do you think I get a bow staff in Brooklyn?
Hey, they give it to you when you go in the arena.
Oh, yeah, right.
Or it could be those big, like, Q-tip things that they have in American Gladiators.
Oh, nice. I haven't thought of American Gladiators in years, man. Pyro, he's the man.
Jim, we could do color commentary.
Oh, yeah, great, yeah.
No, it's like the thing, I was just reading this, I don't know if you guys, I know, Ian, you're into video games and stuff, but yeah. I was reading the new issue of Wired. They had this article about the terrible movie director, Uwe Boll, who challenged critics on the internet to a boxing match.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and like some of the guys from like Ain't It Cool News and some of these other sites went to agreed to do it, and basically this guy kicked their ass, made them vomit and like cry and stuff.
But wait, nice. Wait, you're a film creator, and your way of challenging the film critics is with something
exactly.
That's not film related. Like
exactly.
When you said, "Hey, let's create a short subject together and see whose is better." No, let's fight.
Well, no, hey, that's the thing. That's why this guy's an idiot. That was his solution. Apparently he'd been a boxer at some point in his career and decided to challenge these like pasty nerds that live in their mom's basement to a boxing match. And apparently the pasty nerds thought it was just some fun, funny idea to get publicity. And he basically wailed on their ass.
Well, you know what I want to see?
I want to see his movie now.
Well, he has about three or four, and they're all based on video games. So Alone in the Dark, I think, was one, and like Blood Rain movie, maybe, I think he did. A couple other really horrible video game movies. That's what he does.
Well, look, I really want to see Gene Shalit versus Uwe Boll right now. That would be the match of the century.
I would buy that on pay-per-view.
I think he has Medusa powers on his mustache, so that might help him out.
Oh, my dear God. That's it. We've officially gone into the depths of hell with this episode. It all disappears once the episode's about to end.
Man.
It all goes to hell.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a pretty big crowd at the New York show, and
yeah.
I'm gonna announce that I am coming to the show. I'm gonna stay in Ian's basement.
Oh, really?
And, no, not really.
Oh, damn. Dude, no, honestly, it would be great if you were able to make it out there. But I understand, you know, why you can't, because it's a long ways away. So,
yeah, maybe I should though. I've only been to the Big Apple once when I was 16. So, it's
dude,
time to go back.
If you do make it out there, you have a pass already. So. Because they give out two passes to the podcast, obviously.
Now that you say that, I might think about it. Now, when is
there
this?
There you go.
When is this again?
February 23rd to 25th.
Okay. I'll check my schedule and see what it looks like, but maybe.
Awesome.
If I get in for free, that's part of it. And if I can sleep in Ian's little closet that he has in the pantry.
Yeah, about that. No.
We can snuggle. Come on.
Oh, dude. Jeez,
there's
that's
plenty
it.
Of room.
That's it.
Head
I quit.
Toe.
Wait,
come on.
This is the guy that did the monitor voice.
Oh God. Hey, I hope that everybody out there appreciated that effort, because that was about, you know, that was a nice 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. experience that just worked really, really well. So and I had to go back and find those clips too. I had to go through the episodes and find those clips. Thank you for having timestamps, Sean. it helped me out a lot. So, but anyway, the next part of this lovely, insane crossover here, I promise this is not how we sound on a regular basis, but okay, who am I kidding? It is. Batman Confidential number one, that's the next thing that we're doing here, and we'll be on your show, so you get to do the editing, which is great for me, so good luck
there,
everybody.
But... you aren't going to do the editing, too?
Oh, yeah, right, sure. Oh, that's totally
editing,
the way
it's
going to
work. Editing, we don't need no stinking
editing. Right.
Hey, if it's a crossover, can I get the sensei to do the editing?
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, you're up for that, Jim, right?
You see, wait, listen, you can't see this because it's not a video podcast. He looks like a deer caught in the headlights.
Hold on, man. This went from being fun to no fun.
But anyway, Batman Confidential number one, we've got Andy Diggle on the writing, we've got Wils Partacio and Richard Friend on the art, and the cover. So here's the little synopsis for that. Learn where the Dark Knight first got all those wonderful toys as a superstar combo of writer Andy Diggle of Adam Strange and art team Wils Portacio and Richard Friend of Wetworks go back to Batman's roots in a new monthly series. In a 6-issue tale, see exactly when Batman's war on evil in Gotham City ramped up and how he rose to meet the threat of Lex Luthor's plans to move in on both Bruce Wayne's and Batman's turf. Man. This one's on sale in December 13th, 2006, and I guess that's why we didn't have Lex Luthor in Superman.
Yeah, geez, now you're even getting Lex Luthor in Batman. What the hell?
that's why we got this random
You know what, so do you think that basically, I don't know, just random speculation, but, I mean, are they going to just pretty much go the whole Batman Begins thing and have the Lucius Fox character introduced in there and all that stuff again?
I don't know. What do you think, Sean?
I don't know. There's a lot of... Because, see, I actually prefer the Bat story that he created a lot of his own Bat gadgets. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that, you know, obviously you would pull in and outsource some of the things, but I always liked the detective, scientist, you know, workbench kind of deal that he did. Yeah. So I'd like to see more of that out of it. I'm actually curious to see where the story goes. I like Andy Diggle's writing. So I'm curious to see how he's going to handle this. I'm a big Bat Gadget fan, so I want to. But I prefer the concept that he did a lot of it, or Alfred. Yeah. You know, I always liked the team. You know, Jim and I talk a lot about Team Batman. I like the idea that that would be something done in house versus outside. To me, the problem with Lucius Fox doing it, and I love Batman Begins, and that's like in my eyes, its own continuity. The problem with having Lucius Fox do it though is it takes it outside of the Bat family, and you're kind of making him a confidant, and I don't want to see that in the comics. I was fine with it in the film, but not in the comics.
What about you, Jim? I mean, what are you expecting out of this? Are you expecting more of a Lucius Fox type thing, or?
I wasn't even thinking Lucius Fox at all. I had no idea what to expect from Batman Confidential, so I don't know.
Well, it's actually just going to be 22 pages of Batman flipping through like the Sharper Image catalog, going.
Oh, and by
that one.
Okay, question here. It says it's 32 pages, but is that before or after ads? That's the question.
I need more 3D glasses.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, without a doubt. Grr! But at the same time, I love that the description here used all those wonderful toys. Do you guys know what that's from? That
from
line
the Batman
right there?
Movie.
Not only that, but also from the never actually finished Batman musical.
The what?
That was done. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Thank you very much. There was a Batman musical done by the guy who does a lot of the music for Meatloaf. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he put together a Batman musical, and one of the tracks was Joker singing about all of his wonderful toys.
Well, they might as well. I mean, they had a Captain America musical. They've had a few other ones. They've had a Superman musical, haven't they?
Yeah, they did, and it was crap.
It just sounds like a bad idea.
Dude, Jim Steinman, that's who it is. Jim Steinman was the guy behind this. And, you know, he's great with Meatloaf, so who knows? He could have done a good Batman. I don't know, maybe.
He's great with Meatloaf. I agree with you on that. I just don't, like, see that working. Except I say that, and I would be there.
Oh, I know you would.
You'd
be first in line. Right. Yeah, you'd be first in line. Don't deny it, man.
Right, and I'd pre-order the soundtrack before I even heard it. So I mean, it would be one of those. So I'm just the kind of idiot that they're marketing that
for. Hey,
he'd show up opening day, cape and cowl on, all excited.
Oh God,
I don't know about that. You were fine with the opening day remark. When he got to the cape and cowl stuff, that's where we drew the line.
Yeah, that's only for the movie premieres.
Hey, Mr. Cosplay, what's upcoming in Raging Bullets?
Well, let's see. The one that we're going to be releasing, when are you releasing this?
This is probably going to be out probably by Monday.
Okay. This week we got a Hawkman special coming up. We got part one of it. This is the first actual Hawkman. We talked about Hawkman so much on the show that this is the first time we've actually delved into the character other than our first episode. So we're going to take a look at the Hawkworld mini. We're going to take a look at the Return of Hawkman from JSA 22 to 25, and we're going to have 52 weeks, 27 to 29.
Great. So. Excellent. And you got a contest running, right?
Yeah, actually, we've got a bullet points contest. We have a section on our website called Bullet Points, which is all listener and fan reviews of DC Comics. So basically, our our sponsor, comicole.com, has donated two $25 gift certificates, and I'm throwing in, actually, to sweeten up the pot, a third prize of a DMZ trade, the very first DMZ trade. It's signed by Brian Wood. I got it signed at Wizard World Chicago, and I'm throwing that in as a third prize. So we're going to have three different winners. All you have to do is send us a DC Comics review. If you go to RagingBullets.com and click on bullet points, you can see some samples of what's up there, and just send in a review of a DC comic that you enjoyed or that you want to rant about, and you can enter in the contest. You can enter as many times as you want. So if you send in three reviews, you get three entries. So
now if you send in the same review three times, does that count?
No. if they send in the same review three times, I forward the other two to you.
Oh, great.
Along with a 3D x-ray specs glasses for yourself to have your
terrific
collection.
thank you because you know I'm collecting those without a doubt. Jeez, man. Well, we have a contest here also, and I don't even know if Matt knows about this yet, because I just announced it in the last episode that he wasn't on. So there's actually a new comic timing contest. Nice and simple. Suggest a topic for us to discuss here on Comic Timing, and you will appear on the episode. And you'll also receive a copy of Sin City Volume 1, The Hard Goodbye, as I just got my special edition copy over at CGS. So I'm like, why not? Might as well give away the original. And I also am giving away a John Cassaday poster of Captain America from Marvel Knights Captain America number 1. It's actually a cover to that I got a while ago that I haven't never really had a chance to put up. So if you guys are interested in that, the deadline is December 18th. So you can post over on the forums. You can send us an email over at comictiming@gmail.com. And go ahead, enter it. We've got plenty of submissions already. So it's actually looking up really well. And we got some great suggestions already. And I'll look through them and, you know, pick one. And hopefully you'll be the winner. So even you guys can enter it, except for you, Matt, because you're the co-host.
I popped by the forum thread, too, and it's actually, you've got a lot of really cool entries already in there, so it's definitely one that I'm interested in checking out to see what the updates are on it. So you've got some interesting topics coming in.
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt. And I've gotten a lot more responses to this than I thought I was going to get, so I'm definitely really, really hyped about this. So, and if anybody, you know, wants to throw any other prizes in there, just, you know, pop me a line over at comictiming@gmail.com and I'll add it to the pot. So there you go. Matt, what's upcoming on That's What She Said?
Well, not much. We have a rerun this week. So next new episode, November 30th, entitled The Convict, written by the creators of the original British series, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. So you can look forward to some wacky hijinks that week.
So you're going over a 2 week. You're going on a 2 week hiatus. Is that it?
Well, not 2 weeks. It's this week.
And oh, okay. It's just this week. Episode. Okay. All right. Cool. So that works. You're taking a nice Thanksgiving break. Good for you.
Yes, indeed. And I'm really looking forward to eating and stuffing my face tomorrow. So.
Oh, of course. That's what Thanksgiving's all about. Jeez. For all you Australian listeners, translation, Damien, and all you British listeners, enjoy your not turkey.
It's sad. It's sad, isn't it, that people don't realize the glories of stuffing and cranberry sauce?
I know. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there's at least, you know, two or three people out there who, you know, just get together and have a, you know, un-Thanksgiving day with all the food and just not really, you know, celebrating anything.
You know what the funny thing is? They're probably just laughing as they're listening to that right now and saying, we don't wait for it. We want it. We just have it.
Exactly.
Idiots. <You're>
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful, man. Sean, always a pleasure, man. a pleasure.
I always have fun when we do these, so I'm glad that we got another one coming up. We're shooting for what, January?
As of now, yeah, it looks like that. So it'll, you know, probably wait until after the holiday season to get through with that, and we'll get things going.
We'll look at very early January. We'll try to
something like that, definitely, without a doubt. And Jim, always a pleasure as well.
Thank you.
All right, and you can contact these bozos at RagingBullets@gmail.com in the future if you want to, you know, send them a line or anything like that. Like I said, Confidential Crossover Part 2 is coming soon. We'll have a date on that sometime in the future. But anyway, the email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out those forums over at cgspodcast.com/forum. Graciously hosted by the Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. The links are in the show notes and on the main page. And please send us your iTunes reviews on iTunes. They will be graciously appreciated. Once again, the contest ends on December 18th, so get in your contest entries and send them over to the email address. So for Sean, for Jim, for Matt, I'm Ian Levenstein, reminding everyone that there's always time for comics.
Imagine this. Now, have you guys all read the Wolfman Nightwing so far?
Yeah.
There's one panel at the end where it's the Monitor in the background standing over Nightwing's bed. Hearing Ian's voice doing that now really scares me when I look at that panel.
Sleep well.
Yeah.
Wakey, wakey, Nightwing.
It's like... poor Wolfman. It's like his run's been ruined now for me.
You're such a sound sleeper, Nightwing.
He looks like a little angel.
Well, this is great because now I definitely know what's going at the end of the episode, so.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
We're like the Checkmate of playing card games.
Yeah, no, they're just...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right, that's it. That's it. Oh, God. Motherfucker. Whoever came up with that is really, really lame.
Well, it originally appeared in Justice League of America number 43.
Okay.
Written by Garner Fox, so right. Basically screwing the whole Silver Age. So,
God damn it. Oh, no, okay, I'm not going to do that. I've learned from Jim's example in the past. I'm not going to do that.
I should go bust Wait, out.
He still hasn't learned from his example.
Oh, come on. Alright, good. The rest of those guys are all gone. You remember that thing I mentioned earlier on in the podcast about the Batman musical that was being done by Jim Steinman? Well, it was originally going to begin in 2004 before they shut it down. Tim Burton was originally planned to be the director of the thing, believe it or not, and it was scheduled to be on Broadway in 2005 before it was shut down. Well, Jim Steinman released one of the tracks. Actually, he released a lot of the tracks so far, but one of those tracks that I mentioned in the podcast itself, the Joker song, How Did He Get All Those Wonderful Toys?, I am going to play for you guys right now. Yeah, Sean, it does exist. And you bringing it up has led me to play this on the episode. Have a great week, guys. I'll see you next time. And remember, once again, there's always time for comics.
We are not amused! Let me put it to you this way. Where does Chicago get all of that meat? How does Venezuela get all of their heat? And where does Adidas find all of their feet? You'd like to know the answers now, wouldn't you, boy? So tell me, where does he get all those wonderful toys? Where do all the Disney folk get all of their tunes? How did Davy Crockett capture all of those coons? Why are all my henchmen only second-class goons? If you know the answers, then you make a joyful noise. And where does he get all those wonderful toys? How did Esmeralda get a hunchback to fall? What exactly does a priest hear when he answers the call? How did Julius Caesar deal with all of that gall? Do you think I'm off my rocker, off the wagon, on a bender, on the cutie, on a roll, I'm on a tear and on the ball? And how did Abercrombie and Fitch come up with so many boys? And where does he get all those wonderful, wonderful toys? I know what you're thinking, well forget it! Well, forget it. I know what you're planning, you'll regret it. I know who they are and where they've been, exactly what they're hoping to be. They think they've been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. They think they've been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. They think they've been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. They think they've been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. get a load of me. Bigger than the teeth and all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Get a load of, get a load of me. From the shores of Montezuma to the halls of Timbuktu. Ugh, Timbuktu. Stop me before I rhyme again. From the shores of Montezuma to the tip of Timbuktu, you can see him everywhere these days. What did Batman do in Kathmandu? Ooh, what a rhyme. Eat your heart out, Stephen Sondheim. I think that Captain Hook deserves appreciation for the way that he could handle all those imbecile, nauseating, stupefying, putrefying, mortifying little lost boys. But that's clearly off the topic, which is obviously, where did he get all those wonderful toys? Where do all the country clubs get all of their goys? Where do all the Yiddish folk get all of their oys? How do you stay away from all the awful hoi polloys? And make a joyful noise! Where does he get all those? 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 Where does he? 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 Well, that's very easy for me to say. Where does he get all those wonderful toys? You'd like to know the secrets, well, now wouldn't you, boys? Well, where does he get all those wonderful toys? You'd like to know the secrets, well, now wouldn't you, boys? Well, where does he get all those wonderful toys? Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. You'd like to know the secrets, well, now wouldn't you, boys? Well, where does he get all those wonderful toys? You'd like to know the secrets, well, now wouldn't you, boys? Well, where does he get all those wonderful toys? Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. A load of me. Been there, done that, seen it all, that's all they can see. Well, wait till they get a load of me. Ooh, baby, that's what I like. Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a ponytail just a hanging down.
I want a pony.
Look at that one over there. That's my beloved, my paramour. Isn't she fine? Well, to tell you the truth, I hate every bone in her body except mine. Oh, well. Father, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to... Ooh, will this get me on TRL, on MTV? Look out, Rover, and let Joker take over. Doe, a deer, I killed that deer. Why don't you come up to the lab and see what's on the slab? Oh, look at her skin. Her skin's the color mocha. Live in la vida, Joker! Will the real Cape Crusader please stand up? Please stand up. Please stand up. My name is, my name is, my name is Jose Jimenez. The Joker has left the building!